Good evening and welcome to the May 1st, 2019 Board of Directors meeting for the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District. So roll call, please.
Director Austin?
Here.
Vice Chair Karen Ray Ressam?
Here.
Chair Lee?
I am here as well. So we have a quorum and we will proceed. So this leads us into our Pledge of Allegiance. And I'd like to have Gil, our the newest addition to the Grandfather Club, lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
Thank you. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Very good. Thank you for that. So that'll lead us into agenda review. Is there anyone who wants to make a change to the agenda? Otherwise, I'll accept a motion to proceed as published.
Chairman Lee, if I may, I would like to request that we move item 6D to the top of the order on the action items so that Mr. Jones can make his presentation and depart, if that's acceptable.
I'm okay with that. What's the pleasure?
So moved.
Second.
Very good. We have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We will proceed as amended, which takes us to our, so, and if I understand, Jeremy, so 6D becomes 6-0. Okay, perfect. Great. So which does take us to our public comments for those items not appearing on the agenda. Thank you for everyone for joining us this evening. This is a time where we do invite members of the public and the community to present their comments, thoughts, or suggestions on matters not scheduled on this agenda. We try and keep that to 3 minutes, but if you are in the middle of a sentence, I'll gladly let you finish your thought. So if there's anyone who would like to make a public comment, now is the time. Please come forward and state your name so that we can identify you in future minutes.
Full House. Mary Lee Siociano. I wanted to ask you if you would go back and revisit once again the motion that was made to put Oceano's sewer bills onto our tax rolls. As most people know, we're going to have to do another tax initiative this year for the Five Cities Fire Authority. And with having that on our tax rolls, I think it will have an impact. The motion was that Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach would follow Oceano and that Oceano would be the test to see how paying the sewer bill through our property taxes worked out. And it's become a hardship for many of the homes in the area. And if we want this Five Cities Authority to go through, I think it's, I think that it will have an impact and not a positive one. So if you go back and review the motion was is that Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach would follow suit within the next year, and it's been over three. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. So is there anyone else who wants to make a statement under public comments? Seeing no one else come forward, I'll go ahead and bring it back to the board for closing of public comments, which brings us to our consent agenda. So, and if there is a discussion on the item that was made under public comment, well, that'll be under our board member communications. Okay. So that takes us to our consent agenda. Does anyone have any of the consent items that they have questions on or want to pull for separate action? Okay. Seeing none, then I will open this up to members of the public to see if there's any comments on our consent agenda, which consists of three items tonight: our approval of warrants, approval of meeting minutes, and a fiscal year 18-19 budget review. So, Ms. Tacker.
Good evening. I am Julie Tacker, and my only question on tonight's warrants has to do with the expense you tell me how much it is. It's the update for the USDA associated with the redundancy project. The check goes to Michael Nunley. I'm not clear on what needed to be updated. And then I guess my follow-up question is that loan application and Is that available for the public to read? Because I'd be curious to read that. That's all for me.
Thank you for that comment. Is there anyone else who wants to speak on the consent calendar? Seeing no one else come forward, we'll go ahead and close that and return to the board. And Jeremy, if you could possibly provide an answer on that question. Looks like it's amount for $4,506.25 for update for USDA.
Yes, correct. So as part of the application for the USDA funds for the redundancy project, the pro rata share of Oceano, Mike Nunley was tasked with preparing an engineer's report, which was a document that USDA required that included the analysis and the breakdown of how the costs would be split, and then just in general the costs of the project, so the USDA could see how the project was laid out and what the project consisted of. So it was that effort in preparing that document that you see before you on the warrants.
So was that you said Oceano. So is that it was done for the district on behalf of one of its member agencies, or
no? Maybe I can clarify. So when I refer to Oceano, Oceano qualifies as a disadvantaged community, and so the USDA funding is specifically available for disadvantaged communities. Now, the district represents two other communities, you know, Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach. And so USDA will not provide funding for those components. So we had to do an engineering analysis to break out what is the reasonable share that we could assign to Oceano for a project like redundancy that's all sited on a single site, and to go through that analysis to secure that the very favorable interest rates that USDA provides. We went ahead and went forward with that effort so that we could be able to not compete for those funds, but qualify for those funds.
Okay. Very good. Thank you for that explanation. Did that generate any questions from other members of the board?
No.
Great. Then we will go ahead and bring this back for consideration. What's the pleasure of the board?
I'll make a motion. We approve the consent agenda.
A second.
We have a motion and a second. Any reason why this can't be a voice vote? Gil? No. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Consent agenda is approved. So this brings us to our action items. My 3 minutes is up.
So you're averaging 3 minutes an item right now. Keep it up, man.
Keep it up, exactly. Keep moving. Cool. Great. So that'll take us to our action items, where we would like to bring item 6D, our district administrator and plant operations report, to the front. So, gentlemen, the floor is yours.
So I'll go ahead and kick off the item. So this is the district administrator and plant operations report, and I'll go over some of the it's been a month since we last met. So we did receive bid ready documents on the redundancy project back on April 11th, and those are in order. Those have been submitted to Coastal for a final permit. We're also in the process of preparing our RFQ for construction management services. So that's a request for qualifications. And so in working with Mike Nunley, we're in the process of preparing that document, and then and we've conducted a couple webinars, sitting down with interested parties, interested consultants. We've offered two different dates, and we had good attendance at those, so there's substantial interest in the CM efforts in regards to the redundancy project. So that should give us competitive qualifications when they're submitted, and you know, lead to a better project. We had a coastal condition. We had to submit a life expectancy analysis for the wastewater treatment plant. It was coastal condition 5 for our redundancy project. And so that document was submitted by the district and Mike Nunley and Associates last week. A couple miscellaneous items. We received our new front end loader, which is a large piece of equipment that we use to load our biosolids and handle our biosolids and dispose of them. We purchased a new replacement vehicle, commuter vehicle for our replacing a Ford Explorer, and it should arrive next week. Toyota finally emailed us and said that it has shipped from, I believe, Indiana, and so it's on its way. District staff, we had an opportunity to sit down with folks from the Monterey One project, and Monterey One is has some similarities to Central Coast Blue. It's an advanced purification project up in the Monterey Bay area. Multiple agencies collaborating to deliver the project. So there's a lot of similarities. And so the project team graciously offered to, they were going to be in town, and graciously offered to come sit down with myself and Mr. Jones and some of the other staff. So we got to ask questions on how they set that up. And so that was a good learning experience on that. We've entered into a contract with the public group, which is a public surplus agency that most, I believe several of the agencies, even some of your agencies, use them for disposal of equipment. So as we've taken on these new pieces of equipment and authorized disposal, in the past the district did private auctions at the district site, and it really limited the exposure and the amount of money we could actually recover on these bids. So this is a nonprofit that strictly does municipal agencies. It's, you can go on their website, and everybody should check it out. There's a lot of interesting junk on there, and so you have opportunities to bid on stuff, and anybody can bid on it, and it doesn't have to. You don't have to be a dealer or anything. So you see a lot of return on what's a no investment. There's no fee for joining, and the buyers pay all the fees that are associated with the business model that they have. A little bit of Central Coast Blue update. We did meet on the 17th, myself and the other city managers on the project, and WSC, the consulting firm that's leading the effort. And so one of the outcomes of that meeting, we were having discussions on cost sharing and governance, and we have reached a point where we would expect to walk through all the councils in August. So there's a concerted effort to have a formal Central Coast Blue update to the board and to the public. They'll be at Grover Beach, they'll be at AG, they'll be here at the Sand District, at the City of Pismo Beach, and at Oceano giving, well, I'm not sure if they're going to at Oceano or not. I didn't get a confirmation on that, but that will be coming forward. No plant tours to report on this one, but I will point out on the 22nd of this month, we have a group of 15 school kids coming in to take a tour of the plant. And so Michael and I are going to show them around, and we've been working with a local charter school that wanted to bring in their kids so they could learn about how sanitation works and what happens when stuff goes down the drain. And so we're looking forward to being able to share what we do at the plant with the school kids. A couple upcoming items. I would like to bring back some district goals and priorities. We've got some pretty obvious ones, and so those will be easy to cover, such as redundancy in Central Coast Blue. But I did want to have a discussion with the directors on what other priorities they see for the district moving forward, and to kind of outline that so that we can keep the district headed in the right direction. As I spoke earlier, we've got the construction management contract that will be coming forward once that RFQ is completed. So that will be a future item. And I mentioned the Central Coast Blue item on August 7th is the tentative date for that. And then the 2019-20 budget. I know we have an item before you tonight that's about going to one meeting a month. That would take effect in June. I would like to have the second meeting in May, the 5/15, to introduce a draft budget to the board so that we can adopt the final budget at the first meeting in June to go into effect on July 1st. And that concludes the administrator's report, and I'll hand it over to Michael Jones, our chief plant operator and plant superintendent, so he can talk about some of the plant operations.
All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the board. I just want to go over our plant operations report for the month of April. For the month of April, we continue to be within permit limits. Just some of the projects that operations staff has performed. We performed a confined space entry to remove a submersible pump. We continued the update of our operations and maintenance manual. We began removal and servicing of sludge bed valves. We had Five Cities Fire perform their annual confined space training on district's premises. Ramsey Asphalt completed the Valley Road manhole raising project. We continued the review and update of our standard operating procedures. Johnson's Boiler performed annual maintenance on our hot water boiler. West Coast Gauging and Fluid Resource Management installed a link pipe in our digester feed line. Royal Water Supply installed a new well pump and new system. We did have two notice of violations, for the month of March. That's regarding deficient monitoring. We have regarding weekly BOD analysis. It's from a contracted lab. It's an invalid test. They forgot to dechlorinate the sample. Let me see. And the other is from venting of untreated digester gas. APCD and the Water Board have been notified. These could result in a fine regarding our BOD deficient monitoring. It could result in a fine. If we do get fined, the district will pursue cost recovery from the contracted lab. And then the venting of the untreated digester gas may also result in a violation. APCD, we have not gotten a notification yet from APCD, but that may result in a violation. Some of the training that operations staff has performed, we participated in training on new gas detection equipment, including calibration, bump testing, printing of reports from website, and use of slide-on pumps. Participated in training on OSHA top 10 electrical hazards, and participated in a presentation and training on the installation of a John Crane split seal, and then reviewed and discussed the district's APCD permit to operate, 703-5, and sulfide mitigation plan. Staff had two call-outs, one regarding a low wet well alarm. Operator Arias responded and inspected the wet well level. All level operations were normal when he arrived. And then the other was for a secondary digester sump high level and sludge gas high pressure alarm. Again, Mr. Arias responded and verified our flare was operational and just shut down some operations to help mitigate the high gas pressure. Also attached with the report is the letter from Abalone Coast. It's our contracted lab, apologizing for their mistake for the BOD analysis violation. And with that, I'm here. If there's any questions, I can answer.
So I would like to jump in and elaborate a little bit on the potential violation for reporting to the Regional Water Quality Control Board. So as part of our running the plant, we have to test various different things. And so as part of that, we have weekly BOD, which is biochemical oxygen demand. We're testing the water to see if there's still biology in the water that's going to consume oxygen, and that's what that means. And so we're at a period where we had contract lab doing this work, and as Mr. Jones indicated, they received the sample and it still contained chlorine because of where the sample is pulled from. That's where we always pull the sample from. They've ran this test before for us without issue. In this case, it was a different technician, and they did not follow their own test procedures as required for conducting a BOD test, which is you always dechlorinate that sample. Whether you know there's chlorine in it or not, there's a process where you would dechlorinate that sample. So, Michael is very conservative. Mr. Jones has very conservatively suggested that there's a potential fine. I have reached out to some other labs in the county lab to get their thoughts on whether, this is an actual violation, because our obligation is to sample and test and monitor. A failed test result, when I spoke to the county lab, Faith Zanker there at the county lab, she thought that there's no way that there's going to be a fine for this. Now, it's a regulator. It's the Regional Water Board. They tend to lag 18 months on issuing these type of fines, so we won't know. And it's consistent that they're that far behind, because they're actually required to issue a fine within 18 months of a violation, and so you often see them that on the 18th month you would get those. And so statutorily, if you were to not make a sample and report it, we could be fined up to $3,000 for this type of it could qualify as a mandatory minimum fine. And so at this point, we don't expect to be fined because of the conditions that were presented, but it is a regulatory agency that we have very little influence over in explaining that angle. If I may just introduce on page 5 of item 6D, if you can see the pink highlighted area in the document there, the two pink items where it says ND, that ND stands for non-detect. So when they ran the sample, they tested it, and it said there was zero biochemical oxygen demand in the water because the chlorine consumed it all, because they didn't take the chlorine out. Our limit for that ND is 40. We're allowed to be up to 40. You can see our test results the weeks preceding it, the testing preceding it and following it. There's no indication that we ever produced any out-of-compliance water. So we're optimistic that the regional board will, sense will prevail, and that this is it's a regional board qualified lab that we were using for. So they issue the certifications. The state water board issues these certifications to these labs. And so that's why the county lab director thought that this possibly would not result, in her experience, this would not result in a fine from the regional water board.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you for that explanation. So is there any questions from, I'll start to my right.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you so much for including the letter from Abalone, because it, if you haven't had a chance to read it, it basically says, our bad, we did it, we're sorry. So if 18 months down the road, we've got to defend, we've got this letter ready to go. I mean, it's pretty darn clear. So thank you so much for making that clear for us. My only question is regarding the APCD potential. So that's a local agency. And so are we looking at that same ballpark, both in time and scope of fine potentially, or what does that look like?
APCD is usually quicker than the water board. The reason for the violation is we're required to notify them within 4 hours, and we did. We notified them approximately 2 days after. That would be the only reason for the violation. Just going off of our last violation, our exceedance, it was around $500. So that's kind of what we're looking at as far as the fine.
Okay. Time period?
I don't have one for you.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That's my only question. Thank you.
Very good. Any questions?
No, I... Thanks for all the explanations.
Okay. So we will go ahead and open this up to the public, see if there's any members of the public that want to speak on this item. Thanks.
Good evening again. I'm Julie Tacker. I'll start with that item, the exceedance and the violations first. When you talked about potentially recovering the cost of any fine from Abalone, I want you to remember to track any legal fees that might be associated with that and get recovery on that, because anytime you're involved with the water board, you can very likely include your lawyer doing any, whether it's correspondence or negotiations, the lawyers do get involved, and that comes at a cost to the ratepayers. I'm just curious, because I don't know how this works. You had a digester gas, untreated, venting to the atmosphere for 2 days, and then it was 2 days before you let them know? Because it says on April 20th and 22nd. I guess I'm not clear if it's the 20th, 21st, and 22nd. Maybe it's 3 days. And what... it must smell really bad. I don't know. I wasn't there to experience it, but I assume the neighbors are. And is there like a phone number for neighbors to call when there's something like that? Do you want them to call the plant? Do you want them to call APCD? Maybe that's something on your Facebook page. You inform people how to let us know if they're smelling something that maybe you guys are benign to. The other questions I have with regard to the administrator's report, Central Coast Blues coming forward with some updates in August, you said. Probably the biggest hot button issue with that project is what we saw a few months ago, is trying to site it at the sanitation district plant. And I know they're, from reading their agendas, they there's some negotiation for property that's not your plant. So I'm kind of curious if they moved off that idea, and if you can tell me. And then if they're moving off that idea, when you met with the Monterey folks, I don't quite understand. If it's not going to be at your plant, how involved will you be if you're just mixing the water and not doing the actual treatment at the plant? So I don't know how much your staff would be involved. And the last question I had was related to the RFQ for construction management services. Is that something you're going to see at the board level before it's released for responders? That's it. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. We'll follow up with responses after we hear from anyone else who wants to speak on this item. Seeing no one else come forward, I will go ahead and close it to the public and bring it back for responses from Mr. Gent or Mr. Jones. So I guess we'll start with the, the specific question had to do with the length of the venting, and if there's a public notification process for members of the public to call in and ask questions.
So a couple of things, and I'll start by clarifying. So yes, there's numbers posted at the gate on to call after hours if there's anything going on. If there's no smell associated with this gas, this venting, so it wasn't an odor issue. And I do want to stress that the violation itself, these type of things happen, and so the violation wasn't because of the venting. It was because of the notification. Some of the notification requires when certain things happen, it triggers a 48-hour response. But venting of untreated gas actually is in a different category and requires a 4-hour notification to APCD. And so that was staff's error, was not adequately being trained. And so Michael has trained staff, and this happened on a weekend. It happened Friday after hours, and then again on Sunday. So it was two separate occurrences. The gas pressure reached a level in the digesters, and the digesters are made, they have weighted caps on them. So there's a cap, kind of like a pressure cooker. And so it's all low pressure, very, very low pressure, like less than 2 PSI. But it'll push that cap open, and it'll vent gas. And so we know when we reach certain pressures that we are releasing gas during that time. And so there are events where that happens, and we're tasked with managing that. But when that happens, that's not the violation. We just have to report it, notify them that we had to take corrective action. And so the violation is strictly on, it's not a pollution issue necessarily, but it's the improper notification. So that's the contact number, and I'll let Michael respond if you have other clarifications.
My only request for clarification would be, so from a length of time period, it was pressure builds up, flap closes, pressure builds up, flap opens. And so it's not instantaneous, but it's not a sustained flap open situation.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Great. Any other questions on that? Yep. Yeah, that's good. So that takes us back over to.
I think there was another question.
I see questions on Central Coast Blue and then the RFQ. So I was going to go, unless there's more that I missed. Okay. Central Coast Blue, with regards to the citing the location and the question as to the meeting on with Monterey 1.
So on the, as far as the citing goes, In respect, there's many things going on with the siting right now, and I would be reluctant to indicate that it is moving off-site, because it's that's not been formalized at this point. The Sand District site is still a site under consideration, but I will say that there has been substantial effort in the past 3 months to locate an alternative site to move the project off the Sand District site and outside of the coastal zone. And so that effort has largely been led by the city of Pismo Beach, and that's ongoing. And so, and I know some of these items have been in closed session with Pismo Beach. And so I can't really share any more than that, except that there is an effort, but the environmental impact report will consider the Sand District site as you typically do in an EIR. You have multiple sites that you analyze. So the Sand District site will be one. There's an alternative site, and then I believe there's a site in the city of Arroyo Grande, actually, that they're doing a summary review of for potential siting as well. So that'll all be released in the upcoming draft EIR. So as far as if it moves on site, what is the Sand District's role moving forward? So as far as the Sand District, so we produce ocean outfall, freshwater discharges to the ocean. There are mandates that encourage recycling, and then there's proposed legislation that would require us to reduce ocean outfall discharges by 50% by 2030. That's in committee. That's speculative legislation, but that is an exposure to the Sand District. If we were to be expected to reduce that ocean outfall by 50% on that type of timeline, participation in Central Coast Blue gives us an avenue to meet that draft legislation as proposed in SB 332. And so that's something we continue to track and talk about when we meet with the Central Coast Blue team. So other than that, we're providing our treated effluent to the project. We would have ongoing, we would have to implement a pretreatment ordinance that would be applied to the member agencies, because when you're doing recycled, well, I'm just elaborating on what the Sand District's role would be in Central Coast Blue. We don't have a pretreatment ordinance in effect, and that's a document that says that water going into the sewer has to meet these requirements. And because Central Coast Blue is an indirect potable reuse project, it requires any recycled water of that caliber have a pretreatment ordinance established in the, so it's really an administrative thing. We do have draft documents that we would put into effect, and the project team would bring that forward as part of Central Coast Blue. But all that to say, we're still very much involved from the standpoint that we're going to be providing a fair amount of the water. We've got potential mandates to reduce our ocean outfall, and we've got mandates and expectation that we recycle our wastewater.
Gotcha. Okay. So with kind of that summary, and I appreciate that information, it sounds like the siting is still to be determined, and the meeting with Monterey One is professional courtesy between two organizations who are in the same fields.
Yeah, and if you could, on the question, I didn't get to jot it down on the Monterey One what the question actually was asking to compare, but it was strictly a professional courtesy, and we did not meet with the rest of the Central Coast Blue team. It was in conjunction with us working on redundancy with Kennedy Jenks and Kennedy Jenks project managers, who are the project managers of the Monterey One project, separate group from who we're working with. But they put us in touch and said, hey, these folks are going to be in San Luis Obispo. They're interested in meeting with the district and talking about Central Coast Blue and what they've learned up in Monterey and how that might help the district and as they participate in the project moving forward. And so that's okay. What that discussion centered around.
Very good. So any specific questions on that before we go to the last question?
No.
So I think the last question was just regarding whether the RFQ for construction management services was intended to come back to the board for review, or if we would see it as part of the approval process.
So for review, prior to being issued, no, it would not make an appearance to the board. We would solicit the RFQ. We would do interviews with the top three firms. And then we would make a selection, and then we would certainly bring back that contract to the board for approval with staff's recommendation.
Okay. Any questions on that question?
No.
Okay. Very good. So then I believe this is a receive and file. So unless there's any other questions, we will consider it received and filed and say thank you, Mr. Jones. So
thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll say also thank you to Mr. Gent and proceed back to item number 6A. Which is an item regarding the amended board meeting schedule to consider meeting once a month. So, Mr. Gent.
Yeah, so I'd like to introduce this this item. So staff recommends that the Board of Directors consider approving Resolution 2019-405, amending the bylaws to meet once a month on the first Wednesday of the month. And so I'll turn it over to legal counsel now so he can elaborate on the staff report.
Thank you. Staff recommends that the Board of Directors consider approving resolution, the attached resolution, amending the bylaws to meet once a month on the first Wednesday of the month. The bylaw amendment is rather straightforward. It takes two sections should be amended, section 2.1 to delete the third Wednesday of each month. And then for internal consistency, bylaw section 1.4 should also be amended. If you recall earlier, there was an issue with your designated agencies appointing you to this board after your election. And so in order to address that, we had amended the bylaws to provide that the chair and vice chair shall be elected annually at the second meeting. So the section 1.4, if you choose to do this, would need to be amended to specify the first meeting in January or at the next regular or special meeting if directors have not been timely designated by their respective agencies. So that is just solely for internal consistency should you decide to go forward. The chair has the authority to call a special meeting at any time upon 24 hours advance notice. So if there is a need to go forward for a special meeting, that should not present any issues for this board. One issue that we did identify that the board should consider if you choose to go through to one meeting, and the rationale for going to one meeting was that the board has had relatively light agendas for the past few meetings. We expect that to continue. One meeting a month would save staff resources, would reduce our costs, and we think with little impact to district operations, especially with the ability to call a special meeting as needed. But one issue we did identify that came up was the warrant process. The board may wish to review this warrant process and authorize the director to make changes to it as appropriate. We cannot find a staff report where this process was implemented, but we believe that it was implemented during the Wallace administration because he would not want to sign warrants payable to his own company. So as you know, the board has a process in place where warrants are approved but not signed by the district administrator, Mr. Gent. They are then placed on forward to the board for two wet signatures, which you do after each meeting. That is not a requirement of law. It's just specifically unique to this district. The government code allows, and I think most of your home agencies probably follow this process, that the district administrator or your finance director for your local agencies would be authorized to approve payments. They then appear, after the warrants have gone out, appear on the agendas for approval and ratification by the board. So there still is complete disclosure of every warrant that's going out. It's just a matter of when it gets paid. If we were to move to one meeting a month, that could disrupt the timely payment of vendors. And if you would give this direction, it would allow Mr. Gent to address that issue. So we included language in the resolution to allow that authority to go forward. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you for that staff report. Any questions?
You know I do.
Okay, then off you go.
Sorry. Very quick, though, Gil. The discussion was if we needed a special meeting, we could do that with 24 hours notice, but there's a middle ground, right? So, for example, let's pretend that every May we just find we need two of them because we're coming up to budget time. We don't have to do a 24-hour notice. I mean, we can say, I just want to make sure that we relieve the public anxiety that it's not going to be just one or 24-hour emergency, you know, light your hair on fire, get over here kind of meeting, that we can say a month ahead of time or a meeting ahead of time, we're going to have a second scheduled meeting for the month, correct?
Yes, that is correct. In fact, Jeremy and I were just discussing before this meeting, the effective date of this resolution. It could be effective immediately, but apparently we're going to need two meetings next month, so we would recommend that it gets the effective date would be June. So we'd recommend, if you decide to go forward, to make the effective date the first meeting in June.
Right. So my only point was, again, the staff report was written so that it was emergency meeting or the regular meeting, and I just want to kind of ease the people who are watching at home or whatever that there is a middle ground that we can give proper noticing and all of that.
Yes,
regular proper noticing.
The full intent would be if we identified the need for a second move, either for award of a contract, we would make that. My intent would be to make that notification at the preceding meeting that we are going to be meeting. So there would be 2 weeks' notice in those conditions. The 24-hour notice is for all special meetings, as you're well aware of, that if we need to call a special meeting for some, not even an emergency, something just under an emergency, we can do that with 24 hours notice to get the district's business done. And so that's the minimum that we can require. But if we did have to, and our intent would always hold this the second or third Wednesday in the month, if we were to call another meeting, it would, the intent would, unless it truly is a special meeting, but if it's just for regular board business and we just had too much going on, I would intend to use the third Wednesday of the month to add that meeting.
Is there any wisdom to leaving any language about that, or should we just leave it the way it is? And maybe that's for Gil.
You know, I think it works the way it is, and okay. We certainly know the concerns that you've expressed, and I think Jeremy is very good at anticipating what our needs are in the future, and so I think we'd be able to give you plenty of advance, and the public, plenty of advance notice of any second meeting.
Okay. And then can you, this is for Mr. Gent, it's very clear that this is a money-saving thing. I mean, that's just a no-brainer. My question to you is, maybe to the nearest 5,000, maybe to the nearest 1,000, how much money would just going to one meeting save us per month? I'm talking about slow span. I'm talking about staff time. I'm talking about Gil, all of that.
So I started down that effort to try to quantify that, and very quickly got close to the $3,000 mark on that. Now, I don't have anything that I've compiled to share
per month, per meeting,
really. So you, as you all know, a board meeting, you're, is it 200? I mean, I don't, 100 each per meeting. So there's, and then one of the bigger savings is Gil is quite expensive. He's an attorney. And so he comes to these meetings. And so legal costs are a fair component of that. Another component, as you pointed out, is slow span. And so that's, we spend about $750 a month right now for the two meetings. Some of that's web hosting. So that cost would go down somewhat too. So, and then the staff time for me and Amy to prepare for this. Now that effort does go into the one meeting, but there still is a savings of that, which is a little bit harder to quantify. So those numbers all add up, and we get to close to, I mean, I think we're saving $30,000 a year by going to one meeting.
Excellent. Thank you so much. All right. That's my only questions. Great.
Thank you. Any questions?
Could you just go over the warrant process again? Explain to me again how that works.
So I'll start and let Gil correct me. So the warrant process that we have right now is that nothing that's before you tonight has already been paid. So we've received invoices from vendors that we've used. We've bought chemicals. The operators have gotten their uniforms washed and laundered, and all these bills come in, our gas bill, our electric bill. These are all obligations that that we have to pay. We've spent that money. So as Gil pointed out, all other agencies, or most other agencies, that's the role of the administrator, the general manager, the finance director, to sign off on those invoices as they come in. And at that point, you can cut we would cut the check and pay those vendors. And so in this case, that's what is being proposed in this new effort, is that I would sign for these payments, And then at the same once-a-month meeting, we would bring that forward, and it would be displayed here in public just like we do now, and the board would ratify that. And so the goal is, when I'm spending that money and when I'm using the district administrator's authority to spend that money, it is all within the budgeted authority that's been granted to me by the district. And so that's what, so we establish a budget annually. I'm working within that budget. If I'm working outside of that budget, I won't be employed very long. So that's the intention, that we would pay that, but then bring it back before. Right now, we're waiting until after this meeting, you're signing them, and then we take those to the bank and have the checks cut. The issue with going to once a month meeting is vendors want a 30-day net turnaround on their payments, or they want to charge more, or they want to charge a penalty. We did talk about possibly going to a 45-day net, which some agencies do to kind of allow for some extra time. But so the warrant process would now be that as those warrants came in, you wouldn't sign anything except for the night of the board meeting. The whole warrant list would be ratified in public in front of the board, and you would get to see all those expenses just like you do now. So from the public's perspective, they wouldn't really see a difference, except those checks would already be in the mail under my signature.
So what if then if you decide that you don't want one of the checks to go? And it's already gone. I don't think that happens. But
that's really the maybe some of the confusion, because from the vendor standpoint, they've already provided, in this case, that they've already provided that service. We've already spent that money. So the idea that we can withhold, and that's actually, I've watched previous meetings, and there was some confusion on the board whether, approving a warrant, what that was going to do. And that actually opens up I would be curious to what the vendors would, what approach they would take for services already rendered. Mm-hmm. if the board decides not to pay them on it, because the district's already authorized it. We've already, let them provide that service to us. So that's why it doesn't, the authority issue isn't really being taken away, because we've already used our authority and put the district on the hook to pay that bill. Now, certainly, if I bring forward a warrant and you've got an issue with it and I've paid for it and it's something that you didn't authorize, or it exceeds the budgeted amount, then certainly the recourse is a reflection on me as the administrator, that I spent money without having proper authority to do so. And so that would be that I would take on a little bit more risk by, not having the board take on that risk on approving the warrants.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
I just wanted to make sure that Gil didn't want to tell me I was wrong on all that.
No, I think he accurately described it. And any time a warrant gets placed on your agenda, it's after staff has reviewed and approved it. And that would still be the same process.
Okay, very good. So I guess I just have one question with regards to the process. It is Section 3, identified as Section 3 of the resolution. Is it appropriate to have it in this resolution, or should that just be a board direction to change that policy outside of the course of the resolution, or is that just there for future informational purposes?
Yes, I think it's to create a record, because we had such a difficult time trying to establish the record of the previous process. And it's always a good idea to have it memorialized in a resolution or ordinance or the minutes.
Very good. Thank you. So any other questions? Then I will open this item to the public, see if there's anyone that has any questions. So Ms. Tacker.
Good evening again. I am Julie Tacker, and I'm sorry to take your time, but I think what Vice Chair Russom was looking for, and I would hope that you would all agree, is that even though you have the authority to post the agenda 24 hours ahead, that you would post it with 72 hours ahead, just like you would any other, unless indeed it was something special that popped up that you needed to go down to the wire with the 24-hour notice. Because you want to give the public the benefit of reviewing all the material and making arrangements to attend the meeting. So the 72-hour would be the intent, I would hope, that that's where you were all going. With regard to the warrant process, maybe you can do a little bit of both, where, so as a new vendor comes on, or as you make new agreements with vendors, that they are warned that it's going to be 45, 60 days for turnaround, and that you could stop payment, the board could stop the payment if they weren't satisfied. It's so rare that that happens. But I think, you know, I know we've worked in other districts that I follow, work with the vendors to let them know that that's how our corporation works. That's how we work. And government is slow. And they know it when they come in and go to work for you. So I think the heartburn, it happened to Arroyo Grande, and it happened to the sanitation district a year and a half ago. Liebert Cassidy Whitmore went over the board's given authority. Neither the general manager or the city manager or the administrator of the SAN district, neither one brought that back quickly for the two bodies to say stop spending. And it was like a blank check. That firm ran off, investigated everybody under the sun and billed for it. And the only recourse was here at the sanitation district, and their payment was slowed down. But they ultimately did get paid. That administrator did leave his position, but the billing went on far too long, and he should have been gone sooner, my opinion. Lastly, if you'll allow me, Jeff, one of the bylaws that I still have heartburn with is that only the board chair can call the special meeting by himself. You are each equals, and if the mayor of Arroyo Grande wants to call a special meeting, she should be allowed to. And I think you should revisit that in the future.
Thank you for those comments. Is there anyone else who wants to speak on this item? Seeing when no one else come forward, I'll go ahead and bring it back to the board for deliberation and direction. What's the pleasure?
I would definitely be in favor of this. I appreciate the way that you presented the change to the warrant process, because it is the way that we do it everywhere else. This extra step I find cumbersome and frankly a little bit ridiculous. The oversight is still here. As you said, the risk is on you. So I'm comfortable with that. I have many, many years of experience with that. This is the way most jurisdictions do it, so we're just getting in line with everybody else. So I have no problem taking that jump. I do, though, want a memorialization of your intent to, if there's a second meeting necessary, that try to be scheduled on the third Wednesday of the month. Where that's reflected, I will leave to the wisdom of either you or Gil. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the rezo, but it could be in the minutes, so that again, when somebody goes back to find it, your intent is clear. I don't want you to be hit by a bus tomorrow and then have nobody know what your intent was, though I trust your intent and I think the people here do too. But I do want to have that memorialized as part of our motion tonight. But otherwise, I'm ready to move forward with this.
I am too. I'm ready to move forward. I'm satisfied with all the explanations.
Then I'd like to make a motion that we have a resolution of the Board of South Sanitation, South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District, amending bylaw sections 1.4 and 2.1 to provide for a monthly board meeting on the first Wednesday of the month, and also to make the change to the warrant structure. I don't know if you want that as two separate motions, Gil. Do you want them two separate ones? Okay, so then accepting the potential change or the change to the warrant structure as described in the staff report. And additionally,
excuse me, I was going to say, if you could please also add an effective date
Yes. So effective at the first meeting date in June, and also that the meeting minutes should reflect the intent that if there is going to be a second meeting of the month, that it be scheduled as best we can on the third Wednesday of the month as previously done.
Okay. I'll second that.
Very good. We have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? Roll call, please.
Director Austin?
Yes.
Vice Chair Ray Russom?
Yes.
Chair Lee?
Yes. So that motion carries. And before we do, I'll hold comments on the other discussion with regards to calling of a special meeting until our board communications. I do have a thought on that, but I'll hold that until then. We'll move on to our item 6B, which is the financial plan update by Bartow Wells and Associates. Mr. Gent. And I do appreciate everyone hanging around and listening as we go through the remainder of the agenda.
Good evening, Jeremy Gent, District Administrator. Before you is a financial plan update that was prepared by Bartle Wells and Associates in regards to the redundancy project. This is a work product that was initially started in 2015 by Bartle Wells and Associates to undertake funding of the redundancy project. And so a rate analysis was done and indicated that the district would, of course, need to raise rates in order to build what at the time was a $20 million redundancy project. It is now a $28 million project. And as part of the cost increases that have occurred over the past 4 years on the project, we had Bartle Wells reassess the district's financial position and assess whether we needed any further rate increase in addition to what has already been adopted with our final one going into effect on July 1st of 2019 of the rate increases that have already been adopted by your board. And the good news is, as is indicated in the discussion and the key findings, is that the updated projections indicate that the district's financial position has improved. We have accumulated a large amount of money in reserves that improves our cash position to move forward with the project. And so then the analysis, in a nutshell, for brevity's sake, the analysis indicates that our current position would allow us to fund the project as projected and project costs and complete construction without additional rate increases. Maybe the only noteworthy instances they do reference, there would be future O&M CPI type increases that rate increases, and they've extrapolated it at 2% per year, but those rates are not yet adopted. But their analysis shows that we will be able to secure bond funding for the redundancy project, and that we will have the rates, and we already have the rates in place to pay the debt service on those bonds, and we should have no problem funding the project moving forward. And that concludes my staff report.
Great. Thank you for that brief staff report. I know you have questions, so I'm going to start to my left. Ms. Austin, do you have any questions?
Excuse me. I was reading the difference is partly due to the honing of costs that occurred during the actual design phase, but due to the construction cost inflation since 2015. So you say the actual redundancy project cost will not be known until the project is bid out for construction. So can you explain that? Because we're talking $27.9 million, but now...
Correct. So, the project has not been bid yet. So the real number, at this point, we have engineers' estimates with final construction plans. And so that is as detailed as we can be right now. But the reality comes when the project goes out to bid and we see the responses from the contractors that will bid on the project. And so that's a reference to... And the reality is, we won't even truly know then when we receive bid results that the true number will be actually when we complete construction, because most projects do encounter change orders and cost increases during construction, and that's typical for construction projects. So that's a reference that we could have additional costs that occur during construction, and so we would have to cover those costs moving forward. We will not fund the bonds. We have capacity to go beyond the $27.9 million right now, according to Bartle Wells.
Okay.
So when we get the bid results, we will want to fund the amount based on the bid results. And so that's why we're waiting to fund our bonds until we have those bid results and have selected the low bidder for the project.
Okay, so then the pay-as-you-go cash funding, wastewater revenue bonds, low interest rate 40-year USDA loan. Is the USDA loan, is that something you know we're going to get or something we hope we get?
So so on the USDA funding, the USDA, I can't speak for them because there is an approval process, but it is not a competitive market. So if you qualify, you're typically funded. And so we've gone through the effort. We've done the analysis that the community of Oceano does qualify. It has to be small population, under 10,000 in population, which it's around 7,900. I forget the exact number. And that it has to be recognized as a disadvantaged community. And so it qualifies as that. So, I don't want to speak for a federal agency saying that the money's available and the application's not even complete yet. But we fully anticipate that 40-year low-interest loan for 18.7% of the project costs will come from USDA and at the 3.375 current interest rate that they're offering, which is superior to the municipal bond market, which is hovering just under 5% right now.
Okay, I think that's all I have for now.
Very good. Thanks. You're up.
I don't have much. That your explanation was actually quite good, or actually maybe Bartles and Wells, but yeah. It was quite good. So most of my questions were answered in the report. I do have a question, though, about the item 6B attachment, the one that's got the comparison of rates across the county to other CSDs. First of all, I want to thank all the board members that came before me because ours looks so good. And my question is, it appears that date is from 2018. So assuming future increases and all of that, and for the public's benefit, how does that change the chart, roughly? In other words, does the chart move a whole lot when we go to the full implementation of the coming rate increases as a result of this project?
So the numbers that you see before you that are illustrated there, and for the member agencies, I'll talk about. So you see the Arroyo Grande is 32.08, 33.27 for Oceano. And you'll see that we're all doing the same treatment, right? But so that also includes the collection numbers because your agencies all run the collection systems and service the collection system. So there's around $8 a month that each of your, and that varies. And so that's why you're seeing the variability. Currently, the Sand District, just for treatment, it's flat for all the agencies. And I don't have, it's around $24.75. It's 70 something. So I'm right there on the price. And so the next rate increase that goes in effect on July 1st is for an 8.3% increase over that $24.75. So if I do the math on that real quick in my head, that's a $4 increase. So the members can expect to see on July 1st their sewer bill going up by $4 a month. Now, a lot of them are bi-monthly billing, or Oceano's on the tax roll, so it's a six-month billing on the taxes for that. But it's a $4 a month increase that's coming with the already adopted rate increase.
You said 8% on $24?
Yeah, 8%. Did I mess up my math?
Yeah, that'd be 20% at four, a little close to 20% at $4.
So wait, it's closer to $2. Yeah.
Yeah.
Eight
okay.
times. Yeah, $2.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just want to make sure people watching at home don't fall off their couches.
$4 a billing cycle.
Yes. Thank you. Second question and last question. Hang on. Let me flip back to where it was. I'll hold the question. Thank you.
Very good. And my questions were previously answered, but I appreciated the report, and it basically says we're in a good position. So with that, I will open this up to the public, see if there's any member of the public that wants to speak on this item. Please come forward.
Julie Tacker. The price of the project has ballooned beyond what was anticipated when the rates study was done originally. My question, and this happened when you went for your coastal development permit in 2016, 15 is when the process began. The application for the permit explained the project and said that it was, and I'm going from memory, it was a $12 million project. The rates were $20 million for a $20 million project. So there was a discrepancy. But just this last week, the report that you all sent to the Coastal Commission on the life expectancy analysis says that the project is $21 million in 2019 dollars. Tonight, 2019 dollars is $27.9 million. So it seems to be the same gap that was told to the Coastal Commission back in 15, 16, 17, and I don't understand it. I'd like that explained. Why would it be $21 million for them, but it's $27.9 million for the ratepayers to actually pay for? I'm sure there's I'm sure there's an explanation. And Ms. Lucy was here a little earlier, and she talked about how things are on the tax roll. You might have noticed that Los Osos has the highest sewer rates in all of the county, and that's on the tax roll. But the county has, since Los Osos, there is a burden for almost $200 a month for those people. So they actually have established a way to pay property tax in monthly installments. So if it is a burden for people to save up all that money and pay it in 6 month chunks or 1 year chunks, they can pay their property tax monthly if they needed to. Mm-hmm. So. Just so everyone knows. Thank you.
Very good. Anyone else want to speak on this item? Seeing no one else come forward, I will go bring it back. And Ms. Ray Russom, you indicated you had...
I did. I jotted down a couple questions that I didn't have electronically. Okay. I think you already answered this question a couple months ago for me, but I'm just making sure I understand. I think we asked you the question before that in the adjustment of the expectation of what these numbers might be, changes in tariffs had been taken into account, and basically the cost of steel, which has significantly changed.
Correct. So Kennedy Jenks has done a really good job at following the market and those conditions, and they've demonstrated their effort to make sure that they've included the cost escalations for our federal government has been in a little bit of a trade war with China, and that's and other countries as well. It's not just China, but steel prices have gone up substantially. And a project like this has substantial steel components, both raw steel and stainless steel. And so that did have an effect to close to $900,000 on the project as far as cost increase that just happened over the course of a few months because of cost increase in raw material.
And secondly, you mentioned in your staff report or in your verbal staff report that cost increases often happen during construction that are kind of unforeseen. And can you just elaborate a little bit on the nature of what can cause those things so that the people at home know kind of what the risk isn't the right word, but just the kind of expected things that happen during construction phases that can alter the project or change the cost? I don't mean to say there are things going wrong, because that's not necessarily true, although it might be. Can you explain some of that?
Right. So, And there are a multitude of things. In the 20 years that I've been a practicing engineer, I've seen a lot of different things that can cause those type of overruns. Some of it has to do with unknowns, and so you have underground type work. We're going to be excavating. We're on a plant with multiple utilities, power lines, communication lines, even for our own automation. there's a lot of stuff that could be encountered that are in conflict. Even while the best efforts to identify the current alignment, you don't really know. And there's a room full of construction workers in here, and I'm sure they've seen it all. You open up a hole, you don't always know what you're going to encounter. So there's those type of unknowns. There's cost increases just due to like an example where you say where there's just some problem. Like sometimes you'll see quantity busts in the engineer's estimate where they didn't properly measure the quantity of a particular material. And sometimes the contractor is like, hey, we didn't just have to coat the smooth wall with this epoxy lining. We had to do the smooth wall and all the girders. And so therefore, you know, the girders weren't really included in the engineer's estimate. So
I'm nodding like, yeah, I know what you're,
yeah,
talking about.
But, you know, so I mean, I'm trying
but
to
I get it. Yeah.
There's extra quantities, right, that could come forward in a project. And so, you know, engineers do their best and they're paid to identify all these things. And sometimes they don't get it all. And so there's reasonable reasons why contractors come back and seek change orders. Other times they're not reasonable reasons. Sometimes it's a contractor playing hardball over a particular item where they see an opportunity that they could maybe take advantage of something that maybe wasn't quantified exactly right, and they'll put themselves in a position. So there's really a variety of things, but the reality is a project that's going to be a $30 million project that's going to last 30 months, and I am rounding.
30 years.
Well,
oh, you mean
30
okay.
months construction just to okay. build it. So this is going to go on for 30 months, mm-hmm. With the first phase being 24 months and the last phase being 6 months. You know, the idea that this is the project would go without any change orders. I mean, we would win awards for that. And I mean, I'm sure it's happened, but I wouldn't expect that to happen. And I would be, you know, miscommunicating if I thought that there weren't going to be change orders on a project of this size and this scale.
So then adding to that question, what's the difference between 21 and 28 that's been presented?
So the question that's been, and there's a real simple answer for that one. So the 28 is the full project cost. The $21 million that went in with the life expectancy analysis to Coastal Commission is the actual construction cost. That's the engineer's estimate on what the contractor is expected to bid is $21,100, or $21,100,000. I got a real bargain there. But so that's what the engineer expects when we put the project out to bid, that they will come back. But that doesn't include the design, the $2.4 million we've already spent toward design effort. And it doesn't include the $1.7 million in contingency in case we encounter these problems during construction. That's built into the $28 million number. We have $1.7 million set aside for unknowns. There's $1.7 million, it's a coincidence that it's the same number, for the construction management. That's not part of the construction cost from the plant side of what the contractor is going to bid, but that's the project cost to the district is the $28 million. So that's the discrepancy. It's not an accounting bust. That's specific. That's the construction cost is the $21
million. Thank you very much. That's all my questions.
Very good.
I'm good. Thank you.
Great. So this is a receive and file, so we will consider it received and filed and appreciate the update and the communication and response to questions. So that takes us over to, unless there's a need for a quick break by anybody. Good. Then we'll proceed to item 6C, project labor agreements and redundancy project. Mr. Gent, or will this be Mr. Trujillo?
I'll go ahead and introduce the item and then turn it over to Mr. Trujillo. So the item before you is that the board receive and consider the information attached in the staff report that we had legal counsel prepare at the prior meeting and at some other meetings that I've sat down with some local folks. There's an interest in whether the redundancy project would be compatible with a project labor agreement. And so during the last meeting, the board expressed an interest in the district staff identifying what issues might come with and what compatibility with redundancy are. And so we passed that to legal counsel and in a conjunction of multiple legal minds, but both Mr. Trujillo, some staff from Jones and Meyer, our special outside counsel, have put together the staff report that's before you tonight. And so it talks about some of the issues that we might expect to encounter if we were to move forward with it, so that you can make an informed decision tonight on further direction to staff as we move forward with redundancy. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Trujillo.
Thank you, Mr. Jen. So first, the disclaimer. We were asked to put this on last week. We had to rush to get it on before the agenda deadline. And it's not meant to be a comprehensive discussion of project labor agreements. And just for comparison purposes, City of San Luis Obispo, I think, was the first in the county to adopt a project labor agreement. They adopted it in December of 2018. And I reviewed their staff reports yesterday, and they had 120 pages of staff reports. So we have 2 pages. So I think bear in mind this is going to be a very cursory overview, but we're certainly prepared to answer questions and to seek direction from the board. So the recommendation is that the board receive and consider the information below on project labor agreements and, if appropriate, provide direction to staff. To begin, what is a project labor agreement? Okay, such an agreement is a pre-hire collective bargaining agreement with one or more labor organizations that establishes terms and conditions of employment for a specific construction project. Project labor agreements are designed to assist in large and complex projects by avoiding delays, keeping costs predictable, and assuring a steady supply of skilled labor by avoiding strikes and other disruptive behavior. On the other hand, non-union shops argue that project labor agreements force them to obtain their labor from a union hiring hall, and that raises construction costs. And I think from what there really isn't a definitive paper answer whether or not these save costs or increase costs. There are papers on both sides and arguments on both sides, and I can't tell you that a project labor agreement is going to save the district money or it's going to cost the district more money. And I'm sure that we'll hear more about those issues tonight. There is another type of local preference, which I'm just going to mention here because it's not applicable to special districts. And you may be familiar with your municipal clients that in your public works projects you may have local preferences, which are provided in something quite less than a project labor agreement. And that is also an alternative to seek local labor in a project. That alternative is not available to a special district. We learned that cities can use that preferences because of their police powers or their home rule power. And unfortunately, the district does not have any police powers or home rule power. You only have authority that is granted to you by statute. And while there is a statute specifically authorizing the district to enter into a project labor agreement, there is no such authority for other types of local preferences. So with that, you will not be hearing an alternative discussion. And if you look at San Luis Obispo's papers, they do have the alternative. And they're a charter city and certainly have the police power to consider that. So some of the issues on a project, and please, if you have any questions, please let me know. Some of the issues that we've been able to identify are scheduling. So we are, any project labor agreement would have to be negotiated, finalized, signed, and then incorporated into the bid documents. Presently, we are on schedule, I believe, to go out to bid in August. The bid documents have already been prepared, reviewed by legal counsel, and are being finalized now. If the district decides to pursue this, you should note that City of San Luis Obispo, it took them 5 months to negotiate a project labor agreement. From a night similar tonight when they gave their direction to staff to start negotiating to the date they actually had a signed agreement, was December 5th. So timing is an issue. Costs, San Luis Obispo estimated additional costs for their project, and this is their water recycle project, of $259,000 to $368,000 of additional cost. We were unable to confirm prior to tonight's meeting if that was just for phase one, which is, I believe, estimated at $40 million. We're pretty comparable to where the district is with our redundancy project, or if that applied to the entire project, which is four phases and estimated at $120 million. So I haven't been able to get that down, that number down, but I do know that that $259 to $368 does include what our normal costs would be, or what San Luis Obispo's costs would be, even if they did not have a joint or a project labor agreement for their payroll reporting and oversight. And I believe that's estimated about $111,000. We're going to incur those costs either way, but the additional costs are that estimate. And we would not have a firm estimate unless we had more time to retain a consultant and really get into the minutiae here. The City of San Luis Obispo hired two consultants. They hired one consultant to help negotiate and draft the contract, someone who specialized in these type of agreements. And then they also have a consultant that is needed to administer the contract. And that is also included in the estimate of $259,000 to $368,000. There is express, as I mentioned, statutory authority for this board to enter into a joint project labor agreement. However, it's not without any risks. And there was an article that we discovered that there is some risk of a challenge by a low bidder who's not using local labor, challenging these projects of a project labor agreement. Some of the issues that a court would look at if we were to receive such a challenge, and I think the article identified two challenges to cities that have adopted project labor agreements. A court would analyze the facts as follows. Is the nature and scope of the project such that a project labor agreement might help complete the project at lowest cost and with the best work? A project with sufficient size, scope, complexity, and duration may make a project labor agreement desirable. Time sensitivity and high costs of delay also favor a project labor agreement. Does the project labor agreement serve the broader objectives and purposes of state competitive bidding laws? Secure competition, save public funds, and guard against favoritism and corruption. And then finally, why did the entity use a project labor agreement? What goals would it serve, and will its language minimize negative effects on competition? So that is my general overview. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Very good. Thank you for that. So just to, my only question for the moment is, so there's no statutory prohibition. The district can use a project labor agreement if we choose to move forward with that this evening. There's, like I said, there may be some risk, but then that's a matter of us to determine what that risk threshold is for us. And then, but there is nothing that in the statutes that prohibits us from discussing this and going down this path, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, very good. Any questions?
You guys know me. Okay, so my first question, and the most important question for me, is the local hire issue. So I'm a little gray in what you're saying. So is what I heard you say is that a project labor agreement, totally fine. We're well within our rights as a special district to do that. But a local hire provision within that contract would not be okay. Is that what I heard you say?
No.
Okay, so I need you to clarify that for me, because that's what I heard you say
so
in the staff report.
As alternatives to a project labor agreement, if you were a city, for example, because of your home rule powers, you would be able to consider local preferences as an alternative to a project labor agreement.
They're both. I see. So that's this was an either or. So within a project labor agreement, we have the authority to use that or to put that provision in there if we chose.
Yeah. The basic terms of a project labor agreement is that you would designate a certain percentage of the workforce to come within a certain distance from, let's say, San Luis Obispo County, or you can take it from the district and extrapolate it out 30 miles. There'll be, whatever the number was negotiated, 20% or 30% to be used as local workforce. So that it would be in the contract that we're being asked to consider and negotiating tonight.
Okay, so let me stop you. So just making sure this is clear. If this board was amenable to some kind of a local hire provision for this project, the only I'm sorry, you can't hear this at home, but there's somebody belting out music out there. Sorry. The only way that this board could affect a local hire provision is via a PLA.
Yes.
We could not do it without the project labor agreement. So if we wanted that local benefit, this is the only way to achieve that.
Yes, that's what the research indicated.
Okay, thank you. And then you discussed that you did a lot of comparison to San Luis. I've read theirs as well. And thank you so much to the city of San Luis Obispo, because the person who takes the iceberg right, you know, breaker right through makes it easier for everybody else. So my question is, and maybe this is for Mr. Gent, I know you've looked at that as well. Again, using that analogy of the icebreaker, you know, in a five-month negotiation process, we've got a similar jurisdiction, a similar project, locally similar groups who would be part of the negotiations. I don't see any real indication that this would take that amount of time, considering that plagiarism is encouraged here. So what do you say to that?
So you are hitting on the key component for me, which is the schedule. So, you know, as the administrator of this project, I have to look, you know, scope, schedule, and budget are kind of my main roles in making sure that this goes. Modifies the scope a little bit, you know, front-end documents, changing that stuff. There's a clear path forward to doing that. And so the scope version is not a big undertaking. Budget, you know, that becomes a policy decision for me. And so that's why it's before you to consider the budget. I do believe that there'll be, you know, some cost increases as the city of SLO indicated as well, that there's some cost incurred with this. And that's something that, you know, that we would look to you to decide on the benefit of that, because the local hire has some unquantifiable benefits to, you know, moving that forward, and I'll stay out of politics and allow you guys to do it. Now, that brings me full circle to the schedule, and that's where we do start to incur some risk, because we have coastal development permits to vest and to make those timelines. We have consultants already lined up under contract that are doing work, and if we delay them, we have the potential to affect the overall cost of the design efforts and the construction management RFQs and those type of things create a little bit of extra work for the district. Now, it's my understanding, and having talked to some of the members that are proposing this, the 5 month was taken by SLO, and SLO gave, it's my understanding that SLO gave them the deadline to get all that done, and it was a 5 month deadline, and they delivered on that. So,
if I need a 2 week deadline, we're good.
That's kind of where I was going, maybe a little less facetious, but yeah. So I don't know what their capacity is to do that, and I have to look at my district's ability. We're eight people. The technical staff is me. And the city of SLO did hire an attorney and a consultant to move this project forward. And so, you know, those are some of the things that I have to consider and would like the board's consideration on that, is if we were to move forward with this, I would be looking for some technical expertise, because even in the outreach to our special counsel, they were really at a loss, because they don't. It's a niche market right now on who's the experts for negotiating these PLAs, and it is great that the city of SLO has blazed that trail for us, and we will absolutely be able to take advantage of, and we have a very good relationship with them, and we're able to talk to their attorneys, and we're able to talk to their project team, and kind of use that to our advantage. But I would be reluctant because so much is unknown to say that we could pull it off in under 5 months, just because a, a, a full city with more resources than what we have. It took them 5 months. I truly don't know enough to whether we could turn it around faster than that.
Let me ask you a question. In your perfect world, if enough of our questions are answered, that if this board's will was to go forward, looking to you for knowing the timelines and scopes that are coming forward, what amount of time would work for the time period that we have scheduled right now? So it wouldn't impact what you're saying. Is that even possible? Where would we be looking at?
I would say that there's absolutely a schedule impact. And I did spend some time prior to this meeting trying to figure out if there were any real deal breakers with pushing the project out by a couple months. The exposure really, we're probably fine with Coastal. That was the first thing. How's our permit? Like, are we going to be fine? We're actually able to vest our permit with submission of final plans. So we're covered there. We checked in with Coastal. So not exposure on that permit front. Really, the exposure probably starts to run into interest rates and where they're going to go. We've got, we want to fund now. We've got historically low interest rates. And so there's a desire to move the project forward at a faster pace so that we can take advantage of the historically low interest rates. But my thought is, even if we were able to get this PLA adopted in 3 months, because of we're going to have to modify our construction management RFQ that I talked about earlier in my administrator's report that we're preparing with Mike Nunley and Associates, that document will have to be edited, because right now they're doing the CM firm is doing the labor compliance component, which Gil alluded to. There's some of this that we already have to do that the project labor agreement would cover. We have to report payroll, we have to track it, we have to make sure that we're paying everybody prevailing wage, and that's all a component that we have to cover, and those costs are already built into the project. The Community Workforce Agreement, or the PLA, is a higher level than that, and it has additional costs. I would say if the district gave direction to move forward, I would think that we would want to have a hard line, like maybe not that we have to do this, but if the team can turn it around in, by such and such a date, and I don't have a number to tell you, that we move forward without the PLA. I don't know if that's, acceptable to the parties, but I'm just, because it could drag out, and there is components of negotiation in a PLA, and if we got into some gridlock and we can't agree on something in the PLA, and all indications indicate they're willing to work with us on whatever we want in the PLA.
So let me ask you a clarifying question. You said 3 months. In my brain, I was going to 2 months. So if we could pull this off in 2 months, again, assuming our questions get answered, and there's going to be lots of questions. I still have a whole list here. I just want to make sure that would that require at what point are we pushing a date out? Is there any way to do it without pushing the date? I guess is what I'm asking you. I realize that's saying, can you do something in 24 hours? Well, then it wouldn't push a date. I mean, I'm just asking, where's that line?
Right. So I think if we adopted the PLA on the June 4th meeting, we're pushing the schedule a little bit just because of the front end documents of they've already been drafted, and that stuff would have to be edited, and we would need to do some legal review with our funding agencies and make there's no indication that it's not compliant, but we would want to check in with the USDA, and I know USDA has funded projects with PLA, so probably not a deal breaker, but until we can check in with the team and say, hey, what are all the risks with moving forward with this PLA, it's hard for me to speculate on a date. But even at this point in the game, even a month from now, if we hadn't adopted PLA, we're probably slipping the schedule. I guess my best input to you is that I don't know that that's the end of the world, and that the board shouldn't consider it. Now, if it's going to take longer than 3 months, I think, that starts to give me, like, we're going to put people on pause that are running full speed right now, and it's hard to get them moving again, and I wouldn't want to create that environment for the project team.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. So that kind of gives you a kind of a drop dead, you know, can we do this?
Right.
So, okay, well, then I'm going to guess that there are people here who may comment on that. So, and if one of you guys would be great, could somebody close that door back there so I don't have to hear that lady singing out there? It's really distracting me, and I'm really sorry. So the people at home probably can't hear it because it's not coming through the mics. Thank you so much. Okay, so Gil, I'm going to ask you to perform a miracle right now. You said the San Luis Obispo staff report was 180 pages. Could you please summarize that for me? I mean, and I'm joking, but I'm not. How did I assume it had a tremendous? I didn't read that. I was not provided that. I assume it had a tremendous amount of addenda and appendices and example PLAs, all that stuff. So what was in that report that's germane to what we're doing?
All right.
Or discussing.
Yeah, I'm not sure I could summarize it. I will pull it up right now and just see if I can hit some of the major topics. But there were two staff reports, both very comprehensive. Combined, I'm saying that probably there's 20 pages of analysis in the staff reports, and then the rest were another 100 pages was all attachments and exhibits. So they did a very thorough analysis of quite a lot of things, some things that I probably wouldn't waste time on doing the analysis on, but just some of the topics. They talk about work conditions and how PLAs include provisions for each of those conditions. They talk about hiring procedures, a big discussion on core employees, and that apparently is one of the major negotiating points on what employees are core employees and what employees will be excluded from the project labor agreement. I can't go into the details on that, but I do know from my conversations with the city attorney that was one of the major negotiating points that they...
Do you know where they landed with that? I don't recall the provision.
I believe the...
Maybe I'm getting too technical.
I don't think they had 100% sign-on from the trades, and maybe someone from the audience can answer that for us. I believe there is one trade group that was not willing to sign on to that.
Okay, thank you.
And which trade group? It's in my notes, but I just don't recall.
Anything else in there of note?
You know, so there's paragraphs on work stoppages and which a project labor agreement is designed to avoid.
Covers that challengeability, right? That if you have a project that's large enough in scope that a work stoppage is, you know, potentially a true thing, then you're getting over that hurdle of the challenge issue of whether it is that there's a beneficial aspect to a PLA, correct?
Yes, I think that is correct, although I'll leave it at that, yeah.
Okay. And I kind of stopped you because you got me thinking, is there more?
They talk about the alternatives, which we already covered on local preferences, which isn't available to us. Their project team included quite a few department heads, as well as outside counsel. So I think they had four in-house department heads and city attorney working on it, and then consultants hired in addition to that.
Okay, so I got to stop you again. I'm sorry, but I just heard you say that local hire isn't available to us, but we said that it is available to us via a PLA, correct?
I'm going to jump in as a non-lawyer and try to fix the semantics. So
okay, thank you.
There is a separate statutory authority that's called local preference in statute. So cities and counties can give local preferences to contractors that reside within those counties and cities. And so they are given that authority by the state by statute
outside of a PLA. Outside of the PLA, correct?
Correct. Yeah, outside. This is just a standalone section of the government code. You can have a local hire preference as a city. So that's existed for you even, and it doesn't even come into, it doesn't necessarily include union shops and those type of items. It's just a local hire preference, and you say, we want the contractor to be from this area, and you have the authority under statute to do that as a city. And so when council initially took on this effort of seeing how we could get, because the board's interest was local hire, it wasn't necessarily PLA, it was the direction was given. So council went and investigated both options. Okay. They said, okay, what about this local preference? Can the district use that? And their response came back, and their investigation indicated that no, a special district does not have the authority to use the local hire preference statute, but we do have the authority to use a project labor agreement, which can have local hire preference inside of the PLA.
So the analysis in the San Luis staff report is going to kind of go take two paths. Should we do it this way or should we do it that way? Our analysis is, well, we can't do it that way, so if we wanted to do that, we got to do it this way.
Correct.
Okay, just making sure that's crystal clear.
Yes, that is what the legal research indicated to us.
Okay.
We can still hear her, by the way.
Stop, I didn't hear it until you said that. Okay, anything else in there that of note? At this time, anyway? Well, if you find something as more questions go on, how about that?
I will.
I have the word plagiarize written three times down here. Could a PLA... the message that I'm hearing is there's no clear research showing whether this saves or costs more money. It sounds to me like... it might cost a little more, it might save more, it's kind of just project specific because there's no research out there showing one or the other.
There are studies and papers out there, but they're on both sides of the issue.
Right, okay. Then my question is a little bit more nuts and bolts than that, and maybe more for Mr. Gent. We talked in the last item about cost overruns and all of that, and so just, you know, making sure I'm understanding, can this vehicle help us with that issue that will come, that we know will come?
I've got a full audience here. I would suggest that there's no apparent cost advantage to pursuing the PLA. I think we're going to incur costs in administering the PLA, and I think we're going to incur some costs from the delay of the PLA. And that's kind of my initial discussion. Maybe that's something for the board to there. Because of the debatability of it with the research, and it's kind of depends on where the research is coming from, who's conducted the study, whether they show it's going to increase costs or it's going to decrease costs. I mean, somebody comes from out of the area, it's a lot more hotel rooms, so they're staying in hotels while they're doing the work. Well, you're also getting TOT from, you know, them staying in the hotel rooms, but you're not, you know, hiring the local dollars that are going to reinvest. And so it's that intangible local hire where I think that's the, you know, why we're looking to the electeds to kind of weigh in on this, because we can't necessarily quantify that, you know, by putting our local workforce to work, and, you know, they're going to spend that money here locally. It's very expensive to live here locally, and so hiring somebody that comes in from Arizona is a good topic to consider. And so I want the board to know, like, if the board chooses to go this route, you know, I'll work very diligently to ensure that this happens effectively. It's certainly not, you know, there's no opposition from district staff on doing this. I've got concerns about the schedule, and then I do believe it will incur additional costs and going forward.
Do you have any estimation of what that cost would be? So if the board was going to take action or give direction, that we would know what that ballpark is. I mean, obviously you don't know that till you walk that road, but are you talking millions? Are you talking hundreds? Are you talking thousands? What are we talking about?
Well, just administering it from the city of San Luis's example is intended for them. They expect to spend an additional roughly $200,000 in administering the PLA over just doing your standard labor compliance.
So I actually had a question about that.
I don't think that's what Gil said, though. That's not what I heard. So I apologize.
Let me get to my question. So what I heard him say was that was the cost of getting the PLA in place. But nevertheless, the question was, does that cover phase one or all of it? If it covers phase one, that's the highest impact of the cost, right? Because it's not spread out over the entire project. So if it was roughly $200,000 on a $40 million contract, I'm sorry, I'm not doing the math right in front of me, what's the percentage cost there?
So that would, on a $30 million project, that would be $150,000, so that would be a half of percent.
Half a percent. Okay, so potentially that might be a ballpark of, and what exactly did that cost in San Luis Obispo's estimation include?
And that's what we weren't able to, and so I'll let Gil explain a little bit more, and I think there's some members of the audience that probably know it even a little bit better. So, and looking at the city's staff report, so to do a community workforce agreement, which is another word for PLA that they chose to use largely throughout their document, a CWA, my recollection, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I just read it today, they gave ranges, so I can't quote exact numbers, but they expected the full labor compliance under a CWA to be about $360,000. They also indicated that just the regular labor compliance was about $170,000. So you have to delta that out and say, okay, it's around $200,000 in additional compliance costs. That's what the staff, but we couldn't get answers from the city fast enough to report tonight on this item on, you know, what all was included in that, and if we're even interpreting it exactly as it's correctly based on what's in the staff report. We did have outstanding questions that we wanted to talk to the city about, and we had reached out and just hadn't gotten responses yet.
Would it be safe to say that would be a maximum then?
I would suggest that the city has stated that those are ranges, and they don't know what the true cost is. So I don't know.
Mean as a true cost. I mean, again, if this board is going to determine whether or not to move forward with something like this, to know even what the range is as a function of as percentage or something is still helpful. So I didn't mean to say that's the maximum amount of percentage or money. I'm just saying, you know, it may include things that we don't have to do, for example. And if that's true, then that gives me a little, I don't know if comfort level is the right word, but it gives me numbers to work with in my head and an understanding in basic terms of what entering into this might cost.
All right, excuse me. Let me interject here. In the most recent staff report, we're going to read from the fiscal impact, and I think it answers some of your questions that were just raised. So the total cost for administration and labor compliance program implementation is estimated to cost between $325,000 and $498,000. The cost estimate assumes that the community workforce coordinator, who is responsible for administering the contract on behalf of the city, will also serve as administrator of the labor compliance program. So the scope of the administration and labor compliance program implementation overlaps. For example, certified payroll review, verification of fringe benefit payments, monitoring of apprentice utilization, and cost efficiencies can be realized by combining the two roles. If the city decides not to move forward, a labor compliance program will still be required of cost of approximately $145,000 to $224,000.
And did you determine whether that's over the phase one or the entire project?
That was our question that we didn't get from the staff report, and we were asking the city of SLO.
So again, in terms of a maximum, if it was only phase one, that'd be a half a percent, but if it was roughly, but if it was the entire project was three times that cost, it would be a third of a half of a percent,
yeah,
right?
0.167, yeah.
Okay, thank you. So that gives me would you be comfortable with that ballpark of a cost? Just in terms of a general analysis for decision making right now?
So, yeah, at that cost, I mean, I think there's options for the district to move forward if that was the exposure based on our financial position. I do not, just administration of the PLA, I am not sure if that's the only potential cost exposure in implementing the PLA. So that's very clear of what the administering it and providing it and tracking it and requiring the contractor to do it, that captures those costs. But if there is differential in union pay versus prevailing wage, if there's higher numbers, then you can see incremental cost increases from that, because often union labor is at a higher rate than prevailing wage as set forth by Davis-Bacon.
Aren't they all held to prevailing wage? Hang on, please.
So that we have to pay at a minimum prevailing wage. I'm saying if labor comes in from the shops at a higher than prevailing wage, and we've required the through the PLA to use the union labor, then there's additional potential exposure to incremental cost increases for the project because we're paying at a higher labor rate. And these are the type of questions that I still want to work out with the project team. But so I guess my point is so we know kind of the administrative costs, maybe we don't really know what those apply to, whether it's the $40 million or the $120 million project. But we know kind of what it might cost to do the prepare this and administer it. But what we haven't put pen and paper to is if there is. And when I did sit down and have coffee with David and Corey, we did talk about this as being, yeah, sometimes there is an incremental labor difference between prevailing wage and maybe they can, when we hear from them tonight, maybe they can elaborate and correct me if I misunderstood that there is, sometimes a difference in what they would be paying their employees versus what a non-union shop might pay their laborers.
Okay, so I'll look forward to, judging from the amount of voices that came up, I'm sure that you're all going to get your chance to come up. So please forgive me for giving you the hand, but everybody's going to get the chance to speak in just a few moments. I think that's it for my questions for right now, so I'll look forward to hearing the other questions of my colleagues.
Cool. Any questions?
First, I want to know, right now we have the plans are ready to start construction October, November 2019, right? So if to implement the project labor agreement, I'm just not sure how this works. So this is, the contractors who bid the job would be given this from us, that they would have to follow our agreement, right, in hiring people on the job. So this is a whole new program brought into this project, starting at this date and time. So it's, okay. You say here in the staff report, Gail, project labor agreements are controversial. And can you explain more? Like, we really don't know. Huh? It's either
they
can avoid strikes, or you can have.
Right. It's there's evidence on both sides whether or not it costs more money or it saves money. There's also even though it's statutory authorized, it still is subject to challenge. There are a few cases where project labor agreements have been challenged, and that's why I went through what a court would look at. So we're still not immune from any type of legal challenge from a low bidder, for example.
Okay. Well, I was following all your questions. I have the same ones I had. I guess I'd like to hear from everybody out here and see what they have to say about it. So I'm going to go ahead and have the
public. Okay, actually, Karen has one more question.
I got one more. I'm sorry. In terms of the local hire benefit, local hire by definition is beneficial. It's just hard to quantify it, right? So is there a vehicle or a way within this appeal it, could we even drill down far enough to say, to give some level of preference to Oceano, Grover Beach, and Arroyo Grande?
Yes, that's my, and the city very much did just that. They had kind of tiered preferences and skimming through their project labor agreement, you know, the first preference, and it was kind of like, you need to look here, and then if you can't find them there, you can look here, and if you can't find them in this range, then you can go out to here. And so it can be structured, and we would likely, you know, structure, you know, based here, you know, in the member communities would, you know, it would make sense to start with, you know, within the district boundaries, and then move, you know, to countywide, and then, you know, maybe the countywide in northern Santa Barbara County. You know, those type of tiers would be how I would see that type of thing playing out.
Okay, so again, just visualizing what this might look like. So this could potentially really benefit, really is not a quantifiable term, but really benefit the member agencies and people who live within our borders. And then from there, you can go to, say, San Luis County, preventing tax leakage to the best of your ability outside the county, because presumably those dollars are going to be back spent within the county. And then from there, you could go out to, like you said, northern Santa Barbara County, Santa Maria. Then you have a little tax leakage going out there, but you're including people who are local, et cetera. So that would kind of be the vision of that?
Correct. Okay. That's my understanding.
Great. Thank you. That was the last
thing. Okay, great. So I do see a number of people here. I think what I'm going to try and do, and with the board's kind of prerogative through me, is if there's one member of the group that might want to get a myriad of questions thrown at them, they might want to be the first person to come up and speak for 3 minutes, and then we'll ask you a number of questions. So, so with that, thank you for coming forward.
I think that's why they saved the front seat for me. My name is Cherie Cabral. I actually work for the State Building Trades and the State Labor Management Trust, but I'm here with the local county building trades. I actually worked on the City of San Luis Obispo agreement. I was the contact and the primary liaison with Christine Dietrich as the city was looking at moving forward with the PLA, answering a number of her questions. And I'm also the one who stood up there publicly and said, if you need this done in 30 days, we'll get it done in 30 days, which is exactly what our commitment was to the City of San Luis Obispo at that July meeting. I said, we can have this done in 30 days. They said, we want it finished, negotiated by this date in September. We actually finished the negotiations one day earlier than the date that they gave us in September, and the lag time between the July and September was Ms. Dietrich and the consulting attorney that they brought on actually were on vacation, so we had like a two-week lag time. So their negotiation agreement was done within 30 days, and then it was just a matter of the amount of time it took them to put it back on the agenda and agendize it. So we can get it done as quickly, and plagiarism is a fabulous thing. So, I mean, they have an agreement that is just as applicable to what you're doing because it is the same type of facility within wastewater treatment, sanitation district capacity. So you're looking at the same types of issues that would be taking place, the same types of systems and other things that are going on. So I would say plagiarize away. It's a good thing. In answer to your legal counsel's question, the percentage numbers, it was the whole $140 million. So actually, here's the numbers. I brought a copy for each of you guys if you want them. It's just, this is.
Can you give a copy to our bookkeeper secretary as well?
So there's five of them here, but it's just the one page off of there so you guys can see.
And we'll let you go back to the microphone just so we
see what the numbers are. So they have a bunch of stuff that was built in and what it cost them to negotiate the PLA itself within the city attorney and then their outside counsel. They were at about $20,000, which was pretty low for having outside counsel plus inside counsel negotiate the agreement. So that's why I would say plagiarize away. I mean, you already have something. Why reinvent the wheel?
I'm sorry. What did you say? How much it was?
$20,000 is where their number was at. They had approved $40,000 was their budget for negotiation, and they didn't even hit that. They came in under half of that. And the labor compliance side, what I will say is that you're going to have to do labor compliance anyways. I mean, Les has already mentioned. So you're looking at 0.0014% of the total overall cost project is what they're their allocated budget was for dealing with the cost administration attached to the PLA and the labor compliance and all the rest of it.
What's that number again?
It was 0.14% of the total project
0.14.
Cost.
0.14. Right. Okay, thank you.
The numbers are pretty low, and they're, I think, effectively what I would tell you is what I see in these across the state is the amount that it's going to cost you to do labor compliance is directly tied to the complexity of the labor compliance that you're requiring as part of the negotiated document. So make it simple, right? I mean, you're going to do electronic certified payroll reports. Simply ask whoever your platform is that's doing that, whether that's your construction manager is providing the platform for the collection of the electronic certified payroll reports. The one report that you need to generate out of this, there's two things you're looking at. One, you're already making sure they're paying prevailing wage, right? Your contractors have to anyways to their workers. But if you're going to scan through and looking at your local hire compliance numbers, just have them either enable the module, because almost all of the electronic certified payroll platforms or reporting platforms have a module built into them that allows them to scan the CPRs for a zip code. So you can take the information that's out of the PLA document, input that information on what your priority zip codes are as sort filters, and then you, when you actually have your report produced, you actually ask it to produce and generate that report based on those informations, and so you can see your Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, Tier 4 local hire performance numbers like that. When I worked for McCarthy numbers of years ago, I actually did that for McCarthy. I actually would go through as part of all of the progress payments for building a $600 million hospital. It took me 15 minutes to do. It was not something that was complicated. It was not something that was cost expensive or prohibitive. With regard to your local hire areas, you can make them as detailed as you want them to be. So you can set them specifically by zip code to be the service area that the sanitation district services as your Tier 1. You could even drill down even farther than that if you really wanted to, and you could take those communities within that area that are more significantly socioeconomically disadvantaged than others, and you could put those as your priority districts. Hmm. So your first priority would be the most socioeconomically disadvantaged areas of the district that you serve, and then second, your entire district, and then third would be your outlying counties, and then you kind of concentrically circle out from there. So you can make it as economically advantageous to your ratepayers and your community as you want to make it. Prevailing wage is prevailing wage. So when you hear somebody talk about the differences, the only thing they're actually really discussing is the difference in pay that you would see under prevailing wage in the event that somebody's being misclassified for the task that they're doing. So if somebody's being paid to do X task and that task is listed by DIR as being performed by this person or this classification, maybe the contractor is using somebody in a different classification to perform that, whereas your master labor agreements that would be governing what your jurisdiction is under a CWA or a PLA is going to say, no, you know what, you have to use somebody who's classified as this to actually do that. You can't use... sorry guys, I don't want to offend anybody. You cannot use a laborer to install conduit, right? Or you can't use somebody that is a carpenter to run the operating engineer's machine. You can't use them to use a backhoe. Where maybe a contractor that's not having the supervision or not under the direct overarching consideration of the master labor agreement, they may try that. And so you're looking at an artificially low wage rate, where if somebody actually comes in and does labor compliance absent a PLA and they find that, they can challenge that rate anyways. The contractor will then have to go back and modify their rate at a later point in time, inclusive of penalties, and so your costs are going to go back up anyways, right? So I mean, that would be your only difference in a wage rate.
So specifically, really, thank you for going through some of those iterations of discussion. So, is there any specific questions we have of her while we have her before we give her? I give her about 30 seconds to wrap up her comments. So is there? Okay. Any specific questions that you didn't already ask?
Making sure I just understand the mental gymnastics you just did on that. So what you're saying is, contractor A,
yes,
who is not operating under a PLA,
yes,
who's a, let's call it, low bidder,
right,
has his plumber driving a truck.
Correct.
Okay. Under a PLA, that's not going to happen because it's all being monitored.
Correct.
However, if somebody were to get wind of that and challenge it, we're on the hook for that, not the contractor?
Your contractor is on the hook, but it can be backfunneled to an agency at some later point in time. I have seen that actually happen in other areas where, and part of what happens and part of the way you pay the price, and I want to make this very clear, is that when you get into a jurisdictional dispute, the PLA does not allow for anybody to stop work. Basically, it says, we don't care if you guys have to go over here and fight it out, argue it out. But hell and high water, the hammers keep going every single day until that project is built. You do not get to stop. We don't care what your argument is. On a project that is not covered by a PLA, if there's a situation in which the truck driver is doing your plumbing, then arguably, while that is being sorted out, people can stop work. And in the end, your construction schedule is impacted.
So let me ask you again. It came. You were. I think you were here because I noticed your great shoes. earlier in the previous item, we talked about what a cost overrun could be, and one of them was a little nefarious, which is a contractor sees a little hole in the bid.
Yep.
And takes the opportunity to try and renegotiate. If that were to happen under a PLA, that might still happen, but work doesn't stop.
That's correct.
Okay, so in the alternative, then that contractor would potentially pull his guys off the job until we had that resolved.
That is correct. And then the other thing you're going to have that Mr. Gent didn't mention in one of the very, in addition to change orders, but one of the very predominant, prolific, and very expensive costs with construction when you hit a work stoppage is your lawyer's fees. So it's litigation. Once you start engaging the lawyers between the owning agency and the contractors to determine what in the heck is going on and to try to get everybody back to playing, all of a sudden you are paying legal fees. There is a chance in the end through litigation process, if everybody wants to start suing everybody, which happens a lot on public projects, that you can recover those. But in the meantime, that's where your cost escalation starts to go through the roof. I mean, I've spent many, many years managing public works construction projects, and they are very litigious by nature. A low bid project is very litigious because somebody's throwing you a number to begin with. They've got to get a low number to get in the door to be your contractor, which means then if they've lowered their number, they have to find a way at some point in time to figure out how to make it up along the way. So they've got the clauses in, you know, this bid does not include stuff that's not on your drawings. If it's not listed specifically, if the one little call out isn't there, all of a sudden that's an exemption. Your change orders, this didn't meet code, the PG&E green book, this didn't happen, that didn't happen. And now you've added jurisdictional disputes. So once you've added the jurisdictional dispute and the work stoppage, you're into issues over liquidated damages and all kinds of things. Then your timeline is pushed out, plus you've got litigation costs, and all of a sudden all of your good planning goes out the door.
Thank you.
So any other specific questions? Cool. I have two questions. So there was a discussion, I forget if it was either by Mr. Gent or Mr. Trujillo, with regards to core employees.
Yes, sir.
So what are those, and what did San Luis Obispo end up resolving in there that would have potential effects on a similar document here?
So a core employee would be, for example, an employee that is on the standard payroll list of Contractor X. Contractor X could come from LA. Contractor X could come from Arizona. The local hire provisions in the PLA say you have to hire locally. If you are not, if somebody is not local, you can only have X number of people that are core. What San Luis Obispo did was they said you can bring from out of area, an out of area contractor can use their core employees, but only if they have a local zip code. If that employee has been a local resident of the community for X number of days prior to their actual bid and their start. So basically it's contractor can come from anywhere. We're not making a determination on where your qualified contractor is coming from based on their qualifications, but we are telling you if you want to bring your workforce with you, you can only bring the ones that are from here. It's strictly to keep the dollars local. And so then there was a number on a ratio on dispatch. So you can take the one that you have that has a local address, and then you get one out of the dispatching hall. And I think David can tell you what the specific numbers were, the final ratio that was agreed upon. One to one up to three. And then after that, everybody had to be dispatched locally.
Okay.
And then I will answer legal counsel's question. It was the operating engineers that did not sign on to the one in San Luis Obispo. And the reason they did not is prior to the PLA coming under discussion about a year before that, they had taken the site surveying and engineering work and put that underneath of the construction manager side. And so there was an issue of what work was included and what work was not included to be covered. So, I mean, you guys are early enough along in the process where you haven't engaged or parceled any of that work out that I wouldn't imagine it would be an issue.
Okay, and thank you for, and then last question for me is, there was a discussion about the difference between union labor, non-union labor, and how that is potentially impacted by a PLA. So what would the response be with regards to that perception?
Do you mean as far as?
Whether you have to use union labor versus non-union labor, so does a PLA?
That would be the core workforce comes in.
Core work, okay.
That's what it's attached to. So the one-to-one would be the one dispatched out of the hall, you know, one of your own, one dispatched out of the hall, one of your own, one dispatched out of the hall, but your own has to be somebody who's local.
Okay.
Right? We don't want to get...
Until you hit those local numbers, whatever that ends up being.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
That's correct. And so then I guess the other thing I will say is June 4th is a doable date. I would just, if you wanted, are looking at something like that, I would encourage you to plagiarize, and I would also encourage you probably to throw a secondary meeting. That was the issue with San Luis Obispo, was having the meeting to actually get it agendized too. So there you go.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you for that information and those response to comments. So I will go ahead and open this up to 3-minute comments at this point. So if anyone wants to come forward, please just state your name and speak on the matter. Thank you.
Good evening, Board. Jim Hill, Arroyo Grande resident. I just want to congratulate the board and thank you for considering the project labor agreement and local hire to go along with that. I think that's very important for our community. Keep the dollars local. Keep our outstanding professional tradespeople employed here, and also want to congratulate the staff for the staff report bringing this forward, and the project team consists of everybody who's on it. That would be the from the management to the people who are actually doing the work, and I think you'll get a great turnaround. And going forward with the project, There may be certain upfront costs that are a little bit higher, but I think in the long term, there'll be savings demonstrated on the project. So again, I commend your board for strongly considering this, and I would advise adoption of the project labor agreement and the local hire to keep the dollars local and keep our. I've had many years' experience working at Diablo Canyon with our local tradespeople. I have the highest respect for the quality of their work. And bringing that forward onto this project can only benefit the district. So thank you again.
Thank you for those comments. Anyone else want to speak on the item?
Good evening. My name is Larry Murray. I've lived in Arroyo Grande for 39 years. I live over on Rosewood Lane. I'm a pipe fitter at a local 403. I've worked the trade in that 39 years, and during that time, I haven't been able to work in the county. I've always had to travel. I raised two children, and it was hard. It was really tough. Wasn't able to work around here, but we did it. You know, my kids went to Branch and Paulding. And it's a great place to live and to raise your kids. My daughter ended up being a teacher at Paulding and has since moved to Arizona. But it was tough not being able to have jobs here. And I think that adopting this local hire is a great thing. And I really hope that we follow through on this and local hire is a great thing to do, and I strongly hope that you guys will adopt a PLA. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. So, and I will go ahead and say, as I've done at other meetings, if you do agree or disagree with the speaker, or probably agree at this point, please use jazz hands.
Hello, everybody. I think a lot of good questions were asked tonight, and I really appreciate them. A lot of good answers were given, I hope. I feel like they were. So I'm going to keep my comments short. I'm just going to add a few things to it. My name's Sean Perry. I'm an electrician, and I'm a member of the IBEW in San Luis Obispo. My job at the IBEW is business development, and my job takes me throughout the county visiting job sites, meeting contractors, meeting with the electricians at their homes, visiting high school job fairs, so forth. My goal is to help strengthen the electrical industry, right? I do this by locating, identifying the most qualified individuals, training them in a 5-year apprenticeship program, and all the while they're working 40 hours a week with some of the most qualified leaders in the industry and the most reputable contractors in the industry. That's what we do. The reason I'm here is because I'm acutely aware of all the out-of-town contractors that work in our area and the labor force that they bring with them. So I'll just leave my comments there. I think a PLA, CWA, however you want to slice it, is a benefit that goes, I have read, 7 times in the local economy. So thanks for your time.
Thank you for those comments. Anyone else want to come forward? Please do.
Hi, I'm Richard Van Humbeck. I've been a carpenter 40 years, lived in the Central Coast for the last 20. And if you look around the room, you're going to see a lot of us tradespeople starting to get a little more gray. And that's because our baby boomers now are starting to retire. But we need to give the opportunities to the young people that are going to our high schools in the area to step up and fill the shoes that we're leaving open. And this area is going to grow a lot in the next 5 years. And we need to bring them, if we don't train the local people how to fill these jobs, then all the contractors are going to be bringing people from outside. And what has really impressed me the most since I've been here is the 3 core trades for these projects: the carpenters, the electricians, and the pipe fitters, the plumbers. All their halls are within a 12-mile radius of here. That's where their training centers are. So it's going to be the people that live here and the apprentices that live here that are going to get these opportunities. And that's invaluable. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Anyone else?
Bunch of construction guys doing jazz hands.
It's a great visual.
Thanks for your time, by the way. So my name is Joseph Fitzer. I'm an electrician. I'm an instructor for our local union hall. And something that I think is a misconception is one of the things about our apprenticeship is we're a self-funded apprenticeship, and so it does not cost the taxpayers any money to train our highly qualified electricians. And so, you know, they get done with a 5-year program, and so they have 5 full years of training by the time they turn out of our program, and that's something that the non-union does not have. And so if it's not really a union, non-union thing, this is mainly a thing about local hire. But I just brought up that point because he, you know, mentioned that. But so I have a mortgage here. I live in Grover Beach. You know, my wife shops at the local Ruta's farm. You know, we put our money right in the farmer's pocket. We don't even, you know, we buy from farmer's markets. You know what I mean? The guys that are coming from Arizona, yeah, they have a hotel, but they're going to eat at McDonald's and they're going to go to Walmart, you know, and spend as little money as possible. So that's all I have to say is I spend my money here. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. So anyone else want to come forward?
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is John Silvera. I'm a local. I'm a member of Local 403, Plumbers and Pipe Fitters. I spent my life living in the 5 cities, mainly in Oceano, and this is my home. And I would love to work here as much as possible, but because of the construction getting awarded to out of out-of-town contractors. I've been forced to work in Washington and in the Bay Area. I think there's not only benefits to the money that comes in from us working the jobs, but also there's a sense of pride that goes into the work that we do. And when you drive by something that you've helped build in your community, and it just sticks with you. And there's places around here that I've helped put my blood, sweat, and tears into that are just going to be in my heart and in my mind forever. And I really hope that you guys consider this PLA and putting these great guys to work. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. And who's next?
Hi, good evening. My name is Danny Zaragoza, and I'm a labor relations representative for LIUNA, which is the Laborers International Union of North America. And I'm here representing Laborers Local 220. We represent 1,600 members here in the San Luis, well, in the three counties, Kern, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara. Specifically, we have about 125 members that live here in the five cities. We have about 400 members that live here in San Luis Obispo in the county. And I agree with my brothers from the trades that, a PLA would benefit. I like to call them community benefit agreement because it benefits the community in a whole. One thing I wanted to bring up was that a project like this, it's a special project. It's a big project. It's going to take a specialty contractor. I don't know if, you know, we're not in a metropolitan area. We're more, you know, on the outskirts. So I don't know if we have that type of contractor that can do that type of project here. So more than likely, we're going to get a lot of out-of-the-area contractors, which means they're subcontractors that they, if it is awarded to an out-of-area contractor, their subcontractors are probably going to be from the out-of-area. So if there is not a PLA involved in this project, everything's going to be, all the workers, you might get a few local contractors to work on the project, but the majority of them will probably come from out of the area, which means that the money's going to probably leave. Yeah, you know, they'll be here spending some of their money here in the hotels and food, but come Friday, that check's going to get deposited and it's going back home, you know, to wherever they're at, which if here, hiring local, the money's going to stay here locally in the area. And it's also going to provide, you know, good jobs. You know, it's going to provide, they're going to be hiring from, you know, the local apprenticeship programs that we have here in the area from the different trades that we have, which is going to help the youths. You know, my carpenter brother here said, we're getting old. You know, we need the new younger guys coming in. And it's a proven fact. I think for every two construction workers that we retire, or three, only one's coming into the trade. So, you know, it's we need those workers. And a project like this would bring a lot of, you know, training to our younger apprentices. So I'm hoping, you know, you guys push forward with this agreement. You know, it benefits the community, the contractor, and you know, the ratepayers, because they're the ones who are going to be paying for it. And it's going to, you know, give a sense of pride in the community knowing that it was built locally. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your comments. So anyone else want to come forward and speak?
Good evening, Chair, members of the board. Just wanted to jump in on, you know, and tag on the apprenticeship, the ability to train the younger workforce coming in, coming out of high school. It's a different option. You know, you're going through a 4-year, 5-year apprenticeship program. Not only are you getting, you know, the skills that you need to perform the work on these jobs, but no debt. You're not getting into major student loan debt and trying to secure work in a field. I mean, most people don't wind up securing any work in the field that they went to get a degree in, and they have, what, $60,000 of debt? You don't have that issue here. It's all paid for with our contractors. They get to go to school, learn the skills in class. You know, our guys go for a week at a time. And having a project locally like this, they'd be able to go right back, staying in the area, not having to commute like I've done before, L.A., working at, you know, the Wilshire Grand, being gone 70, 76 hours a week. That's rough. It's rough having to travel 2-3 hours away, having something right here in their backyard, and having the ability to show their, you know, their wives, their kids, hey, I built that. You know, it gives them that sense of pride that's already been mentioned here before. And, you know, along with, you know, this whole kind of life cycle of local hire, money goes back into the local economy. We continue just to recirculate it here. we're investing, and I know the other trades are investing here in this area. I mean, in Santa Maria, that's the majority of our membership out of 805. We're all in local between the three counties, have 1,700 members, a little over that. But we're getting ready to construct a 30,000-square-foot training facility in Santa Maria for these guys, you know, coming up through the ranks. And being one of those going through that apprenticeship program, that's going to be amazing coming from what we have in Santa Maria right now. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Anyone else want to come forward?
Hi, my name is Travis Schrock. Thank you for the time and the consideration for our PLA. Sorry about my attire. I just got off of work. I'm with the IBEW. We're a local 639, which is the electrical union. I'm one of the apprentices. There's a few of my other classmates here. I originally came because, you know, I'm part of the union, so, you know, there's solidarity in it. But a big reason, too, I was in class. And I've been going for 4 years, and I saw an opportunity to get out of class. And I wasn't going to speak, to be honest with you, but the importance of what we're doing here goes beyond just union. It goes to our community. So I want you guys to know that whether a non-union contractor comes in from out of town or it's a union contractor from out of town or local, whatever it may be, there's plenty of brothers and sisters here that are more than happy to go to work for them. So there's that. I was born and raised here. Obviously, all the money stays here, just to solidify what everybody else was saying. Thank you so much for showing up, by the way. That was awesome. You did really good answering their questions. And I don't have the numbers because I didn't look at them, but it's a small percentage on the overall scale of the job, correct? What was that?
The cost?
Yeah, for... Anyways, the structural steel is $900,000, and so it's a little bit more than what we're asking for. And if people are watching on TV or anybody that's hearing, it's a small amount to pay to keep the money local. And the money that is spent is going to be filtered back in. And I just want to say thanks and appreciate your time.
Thank you for those comments. Anyone else want to come forward?
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, staff. I'm David Baldwin. I've lived here my whole life in the county, also a tradesman with gray hair and what's left of it, and not very nice shoes. Sorry about that, Karen. I think the guys are covering it really well. I really appreciate all the comments I've heard and all the questions back and forth, but I want to just make a few quick points, and I'll try to keep it short. The first is that the trades aren't proposing anything that excludes contractors or workers. Everyone is free to bid and work on the project under the provisions of the CWA. So that's not only how the agreements work, but it's also how they have to work in order to be legal and in order to avoid the discriminatory issues that could rise up, like your council was talking about, without one of these agreements. The district here is not unlike many districts up and down the state in that you have a large public works project that is about to go to bid, and you have no provisions to ensure that local workers are going to be a part of that process. It's feasible that an out-of-town, even out-of-state employer could win the bid on this project and bring all their workers from out of the area, and local workers would be completely left out. The economy suffers here locally. Our local businesses aren't patronized. You heard some of the other comments. These employers will take their tax dollars. Their kids don't go to school here. They don't buy houses here. And they don't patronize local business. And they leave when they're done. And that hurts the local community. the other thing is getting everybody on the same page under a CWA, while it may be harder to quantify in dollars, that tends to bring in your project on time and on budget. Director Ms. Austin, I think, asked a question that aimed directly at that. How do we best make sure that our project comes in as close or under the engineer's estimate? That's the goal. And using an agreement like this with the efficiencies that you capture is the way that you do that. This is the mechanism to make sure that you get there. The last thing I wanted to mention is that we have another issue in the county here that's fast approaching, and that's the impending closure of the Diablo Canyon power plant. Many local trades workers work there for either the entire year or a part of their year and depend on that project to for their income for themselves and their families. Agreements like this are a step in the right direction so that we start to mitigate those job loss and we take care of our own local workers. The Five Cities area here is a blue-collar community. I mean, it is. There's a lot of workers that live here, and it makes good sense to keep that work local, use our own tax dollars to do our own jobs, and in the meantime, we help our local community. So thank you very much.
Thank you for those comments. Anyone else want to come forward and speak on this item?
My name is Aaron Verduzco. Thank you for your time. Currently a fourth-year apprentice for IBEW Electricals Union. I'm not going to really harp on what's been covered so far, but I will tell you quickly my story. I got my foot in the door in this industry through a project labor agreement out at Topaz Solar Farm off of Highway 58 in 2012. At that time, I was in my early 20s, and I had my general education done, first 2 years of college, ready to go. Next step, what am I going to do? I ended up out there, liked it, said, you know what, I don't want to take out a student loan. I want to do this apprenticeship. I love the work. It's given me an opportunity to be working class, so provide for a family. That's what's possible with stuff like this. You can get younger guys into these trades, and to work on a local project, it does give you a great sense of pride. I'm currently working at French Hospital's brand new ER building, so that's just some of the things that are possible with an agreement like this. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that story. Anyone else want to come forward and speak? Last chance. Very good. So thank you, everyone, for those comments and participating in the discussion. We'll bring it back, close the item to the public and bring it back for discussion and or direction. So did anything from the audience generate any other questions for either of you?
No.
Great. Okay. So who wants to go first?
I've been going first all night.
Cool.
You guys go ahead.
I'll be happy to go first. So I want to say, first of all, thank you to staff for asking the what-if questions with regards to this, because I know with regards to a potentially controversial subject that there is always questions, there is always the what-ifs that need to be questions, and it needs to come forward with regards to how do we potentially make a large change in with respect to something of this nature for this for a project of this size. So with that as the backdrop, I am going to suggest that we do proceed with moving forward with a project labor agreement or community benefit agreement or whatever the proposed language du jour is. And with a couple of potential caveats, and I may end up after, depending upon where the discretion of the board goes, may end up asking for what parameters do we need to establish this evening if we do go forward. But realizing that we do have a potentially limited availability of schedule, if I don't want to hinder the district specifically, but if we were able to bring a draft agreement back in at the June meeting or perhaps the July meeting at the latest, which gives basically 45 days, 30 to 45 days of which to negotiate using the San Luis Obispo agreement as a template, realizing plagiarizing in school is not allowed or encouraged, but here, post-school, it would be. So that would be my, I'm supportive of moving forward. And if we, ironically, we just went to one meeting a month, if we have to have a second meeting in June to get this accomplished, then let's do that. But I guess my request would be that we support pursuing this with a preliminary timeframe for a draft agreement to come to us either at the June meeting or the July meeting. Pending, again, the questions on parameters of what we need to decide here this evening regarding what needs to go in there for initial discussion. So, but that's my recommendation. That's what I would like to support.
That's after listening to everybody speak. You know, I really appreciate all of you guys sitting here and coming out here, and I really hear you. I understand. I mean, I've lived here all my life too, and we all want local money to stay here. So I did have concerns about the scheduling, the delay in the consultants, all this kind of stuff. But I know you said you could do it in 30 days. Because we're, you know, this is a big project for us, and we have a lot of, you know, I'm kind of nervous about not throwing any wrenches into the project, but I do appreciate what I heard tonight. So I agree with Chair Lee. We can maybe look at the perimeters. I'd like to get more information on the city of San Luis Obispo, what they did, but my big concerns are the timing and the scheduling and what it would actually cost, but then we heard it wasn't that, we thought it would cost more, and it's maybe not going to cost that much. And, you know, what we'd say with keeping, you know, employing our local people and keeping the money here in our community, which is, we need jobs here. We need to keep our young people here. Amen. They all have to leave, you know, and it's terrible. So many of our young people have to leave to find work, and then we bring other people in when they could have it. So I'm for keeping it local.
And then I'll finish up with the... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. That's just...
Didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I'm fine. No, I just said I'm done.
Okay. Just adding a couple things here for those people who are watching at home and maybe not seeing this giant crowd that's here. I think some of the things to add in here is we can all see that it's difficult to quantify, but easy to understand that there is a local benefit beyond just hiring local people. There's a local benefit, there's an economic benefit, and those things are all clear. But one thing that I want to bring up that it's kind of occurred to me as I'm listening tonight is there's such a small incremental cost that we're trying to nail down that I'm looking at now, which I hadn't looked at this way before I was walking in here tonight, is it's a little bit of an insurance policy against things going wrong. And when we talk about a project that's really big like this, that's the way I'm choosing to look at any incremental change as an insurance policy. And so I'm hoping that that's the way that plays out. I very much appreciate former Mayor Hill coming up and giving his blessing and moving forward with this, because I think that kind of shows the breadth of support for this kind of thing, so thank you for that. I can't express how much I stand behind. I'm so happy that this appears to be something that's a win-win for everybody with, again, such very little risk to the district, but such very huge upside economically, but also socially, because as you all know, you know, I teach high school, I'm in the core of it, and I got an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old boy who, I don't know which direction they're going to go, but they're getting, you know, exposed to, you know, the college path, and there's alternative paths out there. And when we talk about career technical education or apprenticeship programs or whatever else, I couldn't be more supportive of those things. And the fact that that's at no cost to taxpayers and no cost to this district, I think, is not a small thing to consider. I am encouraged that anyone can participate in this and bid in this, that it doesn't exclude anyone. In fact, by law, it can't. So that should hopefully relieve people's and my concerns going in. So I would certainly be ready to move forward with this tonight. I am not as liberal with my understanding of how long this might take as Chair Lee is. So I would very much like to hold the trades accountable to bringing it back by our first June meeting. Let's deliver on no delays, okay? And let's see if we can do that and bring something back to us to at least as a preliminary to take a look at and keep this train rolling, because as I very much appreciate the district administrator being so open to this board discussing this at this late date, and his concerns about, very real concerns about financing and all the other issues that go with that, that we need to be firm in not only in our support for this kind of an agreement, but also in the support of our district and protecting our ratepayers. So in any motion that goes forward, I would like to have a couple of things in giving direction. I would like to make sure that we get this done in 30 days for reals. And I guess that's not a technical term, but I want this back by June. And if San Luis can do it in 30 days, tabula rasa, we can do it in 30 days with fully plagiarized documents. So I think we can get that done. I would certainly not like to plagiarize the part where we put San Luis City first. So I would want to be sure that our members of the five cities get first crack and first shot. So I want to make sure that we do that. And there was some discussion about whether or not we should put a disadvantaged community first, and I'll say that I'm not in favor of that, because while I do represent this whole district, I also represent Arroyo Grande. So my point of view is that we just keep it at the zip codes within the district. Let me finish, please. districts within the zip codes within our district. So the two things that I would want to make sure were in there was that, then going out to the zip codes of the county first, again, preventing that leakage outside the county, and then going farther after that, and then that 30-day time frame.
Great, thank you. And all I was going to do is say, okay, we appear to have consensus to move forward. So on this, and I don't know if we need a motion or if consensus is adequate for the moment, because we're not really agreeing to the parameters, to the actual document. So tell me if I'm incorrect that consensus to move forward is adequate for that.
Yes, that's
very good. Okay. So then you started to go down the path. What I'd like to do is to give some of that direction to staff of those parameters of obviously zip codes being first, and then you had mentioned a couple other things and
excuse me,
the R3 zip codes, and then
there's more than three, so
yeah,
whatever's within the district,
the three communities,
right?
So but then also we probably do need some direction to staff to say pursue whether it's with Nunley and Associates regarding Jones Myers with regards to finding someone to benefit the district from a legal negotiation standpoint. We need to probably give some authority Mr. Gent to start that process, and then also to see from a board standpoint, there's going to be, if it is going to be held to that 30 days, which I think is a the goal that we should set here this evening, that we may want to have a member of the negotiating team be a member of the board in case there's policy items specifically that we need to interpret. So and or say, that needs to be held open until it actually comes before the full public on June 4th.
So, Mr. Trujillo, what do you got to say about that?
I think a single member being part of our negotiating team is fine.
Okay. Yeah. Is that I guess there's not really a standard here because there's only one other one. So, yeah. Okay. Continue.
So that was, and then I was going to specifically ask the trade representatives, whether it's Cherie or who else, to find out what other parameters we need to establish tonight in order to make that 30 days. And so I would kind of use the chair's prerogative to see if you would come forward as the representative to say, are there other items that we need to kind of provide direction to staff in order to make that 30 days?
But if you could come to the mic.
If you could please come up to the microphone, yeah.
I would say if you're using the City of San Luis Obispo's wastewater treatment plant agreement as your baseline, really I think you're probably only looking at one or two small modifications because that was just negotiated. You could probably talk to Christine. She could give you a recommendation if you really want to engage outside legal counsel. But being as they did it because they were literally starting from scratch, I don't know that you guys would need it. I think it may just be a waste of financial resources. I mean, maybe, I mean, honestly, for outside, I mean, you have legal counsel. You're not looking at starting from square one. You're really only looking at, I can think of one inclusion, which was what I talked about earlier, which is the site surveying stuff, but just changing your definition by zip codes of where your local hire is at. I mean, you're not starting from scratch. So, I mean.
So at this point, you don't envision any specific changes that would need to be specific to this particular agreement, like
I can tell you there's multiple of the signatories to the San Luis agreement that are sitting in here, and yeah. I can't, there's nothing that I can see that would necessitate change. I mean, that's a brand new agreement.
So how about we do this? Mm-hmm. How about we have a check-in at our second May meeting?
Okay.
And if there's further authorizations that need to happen, that would be a great time to do that, because I'm hoping that you're going to exceed my expectations and come on the second May meeting with a draft. So yeah.
Right, I mean, that may
be, I'm going to push, people. Good, I'm going to push.
That may be a very good time for Mr. Gant if he feels that there's a necessity for the procurement of outside legal counsel because there's something that's stuck on or that is just not understood, or maybe just as a resource for somebody to ask questions to. But I would hate to see you guys go through a procurement process that would just add time and complexity to your already impacted workload.
We would hope not to
not to mention dollars. But, I mean, I'm perfectly, myself or Mr. Baldwin or our local Building Trades Council affiliate head, I mean, we can sit down just on a telephone conversation and go over the agreement that already exists and what we think needs to be modified. It should be a fairly simple process.
Okay.
I mean, really, you're not at reinventing the wheel. It's just changing the wheel from the left tire to the right tire, kind of rotating them. That's
great. Thank you. Thank you for that information. Is there anything, Jeremy, that you need from us that you're aware of prior to our check-in meeting on the 15th?
So, yeah, I think I've got a couple options in place and I was going to talk about, and I appreciate you bringing it up, Director Lee, about, you know, the outside counsel and possibly modifying Nunley's contract to be able to work in some of these details in the CM and make sure that stuff like the site survey and stuff, if that is an item that would like to be party of the PLA, that we get that taken care of and that's not part of the CM firm's tasks. I do think we probably have an option with Jones Meyer or outside special legal counsel. I do not know that they fully have PLA experience, but I would feel a little bit exposed if I wasn't, you know, treading down this path with legal experience behind me to ensure that I'm leading the district in a proper and method and environment. So I think the check-in at the next meeting, that would be my intent. I would want to contact Jones Meyer tomorrow to talk about incorporating this, and would like to get from Cherie hopefully the marked up and the sections that maybe she thinks need to be modified for zip codes. And I'd be happy to run with that and work with council and, you know, and intend on bringing a draft back at the next meeting, but certainly if not by the June 4th meeting.
Any other discussion that we need to have?
Excellent.
I think that's great.
Yeah. Very good.
Very excited. Thank you, everyone, for staying at the end of your very hard work day. Thank you for the work you do.
Thank you very much.
We never get applause. Can you guys come back next week?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Great. Great. Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, we do still have other items on the agenda. So if
we do.
We'll go ahead and give just a minute or two for the room to clear. But do thank everyone for being here and joining us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks. Great job. Good job.
You should give me your card. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean. Okay, we will go ahead and call ourselves back to order. So thank you, everyone, for that good discussion. But that does move us into number 7, which is miscellaneous items. Mr. Gent, any miscellaneous items?
There are no miscellaneous items to report.
Very good. So that takes us into council communication, council member communications. Any communications? Perfect. Then I would just want to kind of bring forward there was a second request to kind of review the Arroyo Grande Grover Beach placement of the sewer bills onto the tax rolls. And I did hear that it was a burden. So what I was going to actually ask Director Austin, if there was any desire on your part to pursue taking Oceano off the tax rolls.
I think it's something that we could look into. I'd like to look into that and go back into
I know there was the meeting, it was here, I wasn't on the board then, but where it was said that Oceano would go first and then Grover Beach and Rio Grande will follow. But I think if it's something we can look into to put a Rio Grande, to build Oceano again, I would like to look into it.
So, just to clarify, we would be either making the decision to pull Oceano off or add the other two on.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Is that...
But I don't think we need to do it right away. I think we need to worry about this other.
So this has come up, this is maybe the fourth time that this has been brought up just in the 10 months that I've been with the district. And the one thing my understanding of past and even watching previous board meetings was that there was a failed negotiation at the rates that were being requested for doing the billing on behalf of the district by OCSD. Certainly there's advantages to not using NBS and putting the tax rolls, putting the items on the tax roll. It's relatively cheap, so there's that advantage that we get to offload that. We hire a consultant, they work with the auditor, put the Oceano's bills on the tax roll, and we collect them that way. We could move the direction of putting the other agencies on, but right now the billing goes off without much of a hiccup from them. Stuff is being passed through relatively on time and with little error. So that's why there's been no movement to bring the other ones on to the tax rolls. But there was a disconnect back in 2013, 2014, and Linda probably, I'm sorry, Director Austin, could elaborate on that. And so that's really the only consideration. If we could come to an agreeable billing structure that was, reasonable and roughly equivalent to what AG and Grover charges, I think the district would be in a position to propose, recommending going back off of that.
Gotcha.
Something I should take to my board and see what they would like to do on that.
And because that was the difference this evening, is that was the first time I think I had heard potentially taking Oceano off of that. I think we're pretty clear Rio Grande and Grover Beach don't want to consider that process at this point, barring new information. But this was the kind of the first time I had heard someone say maybe we should consider taking Oceano off of that rolls. So if you want to take that back to your board and have that discussion, and then we can kind of consider that. I had another item, but apparently I have misplaced it. So, but I will say, just from under member communications, that I will not be in the area for our second meeting. So my alternate will need to be here. So I was pushing for June 4th, but I'm sure my alternate, Barbara, will. I can bring her up to speed on the discussion of PLAs if it does happen to reside back on the May 15th agenda. So, but other than that, any other communications? If not, we will go ahead and adjourn to closed session. Mr. Trujillo, if you would announce the closed session, please.
Thank you. The Board of Directors will recess to confer with labor negotiators, agency designated representatives are Jeremy Gent and Alicia Lara. Employee organization is SEIU.
Thank you for that. Is there any member of the public that wants to speak prior to closed session on this item? Seeing no one come forward, we are going to adjourn to closed session. Thank you much.